This is Steve Maxter conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Chuck Carlock on the 5th of May, year 2000, at approximately 1:45 p.m. in the afternoon, Las Vegas, Nevada. Mr. Carlock, would you please begin by giving us a brief biographical sketch of yourself?
Okay, I was born at Cleburne, Texas, and lived about 7 miles from there my whole life until I went in the military. At a place called Joshua, Texas, went to high school there, and then I went to University of Texas at Arlington to college for about 2 years, and then I dropped out of there and knew I was fixing to get drafted, and so I joined the military.
And that was in 1966 that you joined?
Yes.
How much did you know about Vietnam and what was going on in Vietnam when you made that decision to go in the Army?
I knew at the time that it was going to take 2 months for basic training, 9 months for flight school, and about a month leave. And from what I was reading, I knew the war would be over by the time I got out of flight school, so I thought I'd never have to go to Vietnam. I never thought I was going to Vietnam until I moved to Fort Rucker, which I had about 2 or 3 months left, and I thought, holy smokes, I'm going to Vietnam. But I really thought the war would be over from the press, what I'd been reading, that you know, the Marines had went in 65, and we were going to kick their rumps real quick. So.
What did, from what you heard in the news and everything else, what did you think was going on in Vietnam? What kind of war was it?
More of a guerrilla kind of war, no real heavy fighting, like skirmishing, stuff like that. Didn't really realize what was going on in the helicopters. Didn't really understand what they need so many helicopter pilots. That was not to publicize that kind of war. It was more of the only thing I really remember was the Marines around Da Nang. Mm-hmm. That was the, and they were beginning to do some sweep operations. Mm-hmm. I do remember a, and I've got a copy of this, a Time magazine, where the guy got killed in an OH-34 Marine pilot, which was a famous photos, and the crew man was crying in the back. And I remember looking at that, and never crossed my mind, I guess, that the Army was going to be doing the same thing.
Okay. What prompted you to go aviation? And was that something you went, I guess, is it officer or warrant officer?
Warrant officer. What it was, a guy from my hometown had went to helicopter flight school, and he was telling me how great it was. And as a matter of fact, he got shot in the arm and was wounded 2 or 3 times over there. And but anyway, I was really going into Marines. And the sergeant, the recruiting sergeant, was trying to say, hang on, we're pretty sure we're going to drop it to 2 years of college, you get to fly in the Marines. And they were saying jet pilot, which was hooey, because they would have made me a helicopter pilot. Mm-hmm. And instead, the Army guy said, I'll guarantee it to you right now. So I had a little contest between the Marines and the Army, and I signed up with the Army, because they guaranteed it right up front.
Mm-hmm. And when you made the decision to enlist, you were about to be drafted. Was part of the choice to enlist before drafting the idea that you had have control or more control over your military destiny?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Was that common amongst guys that you knew?
Yes, I would say so. Yeah. I saw some people in boot camp drafted that had college degrees, and I always wondered, a draftee got 2 years, and where you sign up generally is three. In the helicopter flight school, it was the time you were there, which is like 11 or 12 months, and then 3 years from the date you graduate, so it was like a 4-year deal. And so any of them that didn't do it just made the decision, I'll take whatever my lumps are, and I'll only go for 2 years.
Okay. So how old were you when you went into the Army to basic training?
I would have been 20 years old.
20?
20 years old.
Where did you go to basic training?
Fort Polk.
What was that like? What was basic like?
It was fairly tough. I became the truck driver, and there was a kid in there that knew I was a truck driver. He volunteered me, so that was an easier job. Mm-hmm. I got out a lot of the staying out in the field and a lot of the morning runs, because I had to go down and pick the truck up. So, but that was basically it. That's about all I remember. It was strange, but I was not in good shape like I thought I was. Mm-hmm. and once I got in shape, then it was wasn't much to it, you know.
What kind of weapons training did you receive in basic?
What happened, we went down because I was a truck driver. I kept wondering when they were going to let me shoot a rifle. And they were already qualifying everybody, and I had never fired a rifle down there, and the sergeant figured it out, and he said, "Oh, my God, you haven't even fired." He said, "Can you shoot this thing?" And I said, "Yes." So he carried me down and sighted my weapon for me because he had to give me a few rounds before we actually walked over and qualified, and I shot not the top, but the next, whatever the middle class was. And he was happy I passed. But they just skipped it. I never said anything. But I never fired a rifle until right before I qualified at the end of boot camp.
What weapon was that?
M14.
The M14?
Yeah, it was M14.
And when you got to Vietnam, did you ever use the M14, or did you go
straight to the M16? No, I never saw one in Vietnam. They gave us an M16 as soon as I got there.
What did you think about the difference between the two?
Well, the M16 is a piece of junk. It wouldn't fire. You had to clean it all the time. I don't even remember cleaning mine, and then we'd pick up these other weapons, and we'd carry AK-47s and stuff like that. But you heard so many stories about it, but we'd go out and we had a shooting pit down at the flight line, so we could walk out behind where we slept and just fire into this pit. And you'd walk out there after you clean them, and a day later they wouldn't shoot. We'd pick up a lot of sand inside those helicopters. Sand and grit, and it'd knock those things out. And they changed them later in my tour, changed the bolt in them. And by then, we didn't pay much attention to them. You know, we knew it was better to run than it was to shoot back, you know. But most of the time, we'd carry AK-47s, and I had a Sten gun. Then I carried a grease gun for a while. But the Special Forces gave me a Sten gun.
Special Forces gave you a Sten.
Sten gun with a silencer on it.
So there weren't any regulations or orders not to carry weapons that weren't issued or anything like that?
About once every month and a half, they'd come through and make you put them, take them all away, and you'd hide them for a little bit, and then a couple of days later, you'd be carrying them again, and nobody'd say anything. So it was, they had explosive ammo. Supposedly the Special Forces were putting it out. And they'd salt up their ammo, and then some of our guys would catch one of those rounds. You know, they'd capture it, and then it'd blow their guns up. So that was their concern. And they talked about that when I was there, but we didn't care. We shot AK-47s all the time.
But you could use American ammunition in the AK-47?
No.
You couldn't?
No. No, that round was different. It might have been the same length, but it was different. That was a 223 or something. No, it wouldn't fire in there.
Oh, no, I meant the 7.62. The American 7.62 for the M60 machine gun, I was under the impression that that would also fit the AK-47.
It might have. I don't know that. Yeah. We never used it that way. You might ask somebody else, but no. No, the M16 round wouldn't fit over there, but I don't know about that other now.
What about other weapons? As far as, would you guys capture and use RPGs and things like that?
No.
Just the small arms?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so basic training, you completed in 2 months, then you went on to flight school, straight into flight school from basic.
Yes, what happened, there was a little confusion over how long we were off, but I remember being off like 30 days. Somehow the timing was off, and they let us go. And there's another guy said his class started a certain time. It was around January of '67 is when I got actually into to flight school.
Okay, so what was flight school like?
I started to quit. I need sleep, and I've studied some stuff about how the German army trained their soldiers, and this clearly works, is high stress, lack of sleep. It actually, you weed out the guys that have problems, and we had some guys that just couldn't take it, and I was right on the border, because I went and told them, one of the guys, I said, "I'm going to quit," and so anyway, they called me down there and chewed me out real good, and he told the TAC officer, they called him, and he called me down there and ripped me up pretty good. I could fly the helicopter, and but anyway, they talked me out of quitting. They said, "Ah, don't quit," and it got a lot better when we got to Fort Rucker. But they'd come in and harass us all night long, get you up at all hours of the night, keep you up working all the time. Then you had to study. You actually had to study for some of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing I was getting 3 hours, 3.5 hours of sleep. And I heard they changed a lot of that later on. Mm-hmm. That they figured out some people were crashing those helicopters
for lack
of sleep. But it worked from the point of view that it is mental toughening. That is that's a trait of the German army, I've heard. Mm-hmm. The old German army. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, just don't let them sleep and let's figure out who the tough guys are and get move the others to do something else, you know. Right. And,
well, were there any accidents during your aviator training?
Not in my flight group, not that I remember. If it was, it wasn't anything major. Nobody that I remember got killed in our flight class, but there were always accidents out there, different mid-air collisions and stuff like that, yeah.
What was the primary cause of accidents like that?
Just guys out there flying. I instructed when I came back from Vietnam, and I was nearly killed 3 or 4 times before I'd never get another helicopter in my life. I've been in several over 30 years, but that was more dangerous than Vietnam. Trying to teach these students entering traffic patterns together. 500 helicopters converging at one time, and they had this system to do it. But that was the most dangerous thing. I say more dangerous than Vietnam, no way, but it was pretty dangerous.
Yeah.
Getting run over.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
And the conversions of this was part of the overall training for all students?
No, just to come back into the heliport.
Oh, okay.
In other words, you think you're coming, you've launched 500 helicopters out of here, and they all have to be back within about 4 hours because you'd launch them back out again.
Yeah.
So how do you get 500 helicopters landed within just a few minutes of each other? And they had these colored telephone poles, and you're supposed to be on a certain line of poles, and there was 3 pads to come in. They had 500 coming out of one heliport at Mineral Wells and 500 coming out of the main, and they stayed away from us. They were on the opposite side of the road. But there's just no way you can bring that many in that quick without some danger, especially when we've got students flying.
Mm-hmm.
When you had instructors, it's no big deal.
Yeah.
And very dangerous. Just out instructing, you run the risk of crashing, but not a mid-air collision.
Yeah.
I saw a mid-air collision one day. My wife was looking straight at it behind the Holiday Inn out of Mineral Wells, and we looked up and saw 2 of them run together, kill 3 people. And I was one of the second guys out there, but that happened quite often. And out of our class, it didn't happen to anybody in our flight class going through.
But while you were there, it did happen.
That was when I came back. But while I was there, they had mid-air collisions too. I just didn't know them.
Okay.
I didn't know who they were, and I didn't see them. But I actually witnessed one myself.
As an instructor back
at
Fort Rucker.
Yeah, and I was in my car driving down the road and saw it. And my wife was looking straight at it when they hit. So, but it's just dangerous. It's a student. They have trouble flying the thing, much less looking around at the same time.
Was flight school effective in preparing you for Vietnam?
Yes, you should always have a little more time doing anything, but that's when they start you out as a co-pilot over there. In Vietnam, you don't get to make a lot of decisions starting out. But it was good. You had a basic understanding. Probably you had a better understanding than if you went to a civilian school to get I can't even remember, 100 hours of flight time, whatever we had.
Mm-hmm.
I could sort of count it up if I had to, but however many hours we had, maybe it was 200 hours when we came out, but you were pretty well trained. You paid attention during that 200 hours, but you still couldn't fly combat. You just weren't skilled to fly a loaded helicopter. It's not worth their time and it's too dangerous to load a helicopter up like we did in Vietnam and try to teach somebody to do that. It's better to do it over there gradually, because that's quite an experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were trained on the Huey at Fort Rucker, weren't you?
Yeah, at Fort Rucker.
Okay.
Yeah.
What were the other aircraft you trained on?
I flew a TH-55, which is a little bubble job. I flew that at Mineral Wells. And then when I got to Fort Rucker, I was in another bubble job that was a, we call them H-13s.
Uh-huh.
And that was for instrument.
Okay.
And then after that, then we got into Hueys.
Okay. And was there anything, when you got to Vietnam, did you ever think, boy, I wish they would have taught me this at flight school? Were there any incidents where you thought of something that they probably should have emphasized, probably should have done? to make flight school more effective?
Right now, no.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
We got either 25 or 50 hours of instrument time. I really can't remember the two, but that's about as much. And it was fairly good. I mean, you can't ever get enough of that. First time you do the real deal, it is totally different than flying with a hood over your head.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just no way you can do that unless you just take a student and take him up in the clouds. Mm-hmm. And that's too dangerous.
Yeah.
You just can't take that many students up in the clouds. So that would probably be the only thing, and I doubt they're doing that right now.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be shocked if they're letting students go up into the clouds to practice real-time instrument flying.
Yeah. Did you have any weapons training, helicopter weapons training?
Just a little dab. I was the first class where they actually picked some to go to some gun training, but it was really a waste of time. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to pull a trigger on a minigun or to pop a rocket on somebody. That's the least of the deals.
You know?
And that's all they really gave us was just we went out and fired some rockets and we might have shot a minigun. I can't remember what we did. But that's the reason I wound up in the gun platoon when I first got there because I was, quote, trained to be in the gun platoon.
Mm-hmm. But you weren't taught how to actually alter the course of your rounds going in?
Or no. Yeah. No,
how to aim properly, stuff like that.
You were just sitting there, you know.
Yeah. Just actually fired the weapon.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Did they? Did you train on the 40mm as well at that point, or
no?
Just the 2.75 rockets and the miniguns.
Yes.
Okay. Did you know when you were leaving flight school, getting ready to graduate and move on? Did you know where you were going in terms of in Vietnam?
What happens? They cut you a set of orders. Apparently, this is fairly standard. They just cut you a set of orders to a company. And then that means nothing. All that does is get you to Vietnam. They get you the money drawn. They get you all this. They have to say they're going to send you somewhere. Mm-hmm. Once you get in country is when they decide where you're going. And I went up to replace a whole bunch of pilots that got killed and wounded. We'd heard about it while I was at the replacement center, and we heard what companies it was, and I saw the 71st, the helicopter land up there with a 71 on the door, and I thought, surely they're not coming after me because I'm supposed to have went to a different place.
Mm-hmm.
And they called off the name, said, you get on that helicopter. And I went, oh. that's how I wound up with the 71st Assault Helicopter Company.
Mm-hmm. Okay, it was actually Assault Helicopter, not Attack.
Right, Assault Helicopter Company. Now, the difference there, I don't know.
Yeah.
They just called us that.
Mm-hmm. And this unit had both slicks for troop carrying and also the gunships, the Firebirds.
That's correct. And that's the reason they call it Assault, I guess. I think a technical company was more of a resupply troop carrier or something like that. And the Assault had a gun platoon with it. So
okay.
So I think that was the difference.
So only one gun platoon in the company?
Yes.
How many ships in that platoon?
Eight. You tried to have eight ships, and we were lucky if we ever got four up. Mm-hmm. At one time, I vaguely remember us getting five flying one time, and then most times if we had three, we were very lucky. That's combat damage, maintenance, and structural problems.
Yeah.
They weren't made to carry that much weight and be cowboyed around like we used to cowboy.
Mm-hmm.
Had a tendency to tear them up.
Mm-hmm. So let's see. This is when you first got to Vietnam. This was late '67 or early '67.
Yeah, September '67.
September '67. And the primary area of operations for the 71st was in Chu Lai, is that correct?
Chu Lai, south of Da Nang.
Mm-hmm. So why don't you go ahead and describe the first impressions that you had when you got to the 71st, I guess, fire base, the area in which you were operating from. You know, what did you think when you started meeting these guys you're going to be flying combat missions with?
Well, it wasn't a pleasant experience. I was the first guys, the gun platoon, to do that kind of business, you had to have this macho attitude. And you had to be perceived as macho. Mm-hmm. And they never let a rookie come into the gun platoon. And because me and a couple of these other guys had done this gun training, the company commander just put us over there. So they were automatically mad at the company commander. Plus, they were plenty mad at us for coming in there. And because before, they asked the people to come in. It was sort of a pick and choose as to who got in the gun platoon. And here they took, there was three of us that I remember that just got pushed in there within 30 days.
So you weren't warmly welcomed.
That's correct.
Any particular incidents that you recall? Or?
No, just people being rude to you.
Okay. Any use of the expression FNG or anything like that?
I really don't remember that term much.
Okay.
I, you know, that's always in all the books and stuff, but I really don't remember them using that term. I think asshole was more appropriate. You know, what's that guy doing living in our hoots over here? You know, they were really upset.
Wow.
And but these guys became my friend shortly. Mm-hmm. It didn't take long, and they figured out who'd hang with them and didn't freak out. They wanted somebody pretty cool in there in case they got hurt or got into the night. We flew at night a lot, so that was, and I can see their point of view. You didn't want some rookie up there out flying in those mountains in the dark that didn't have a clue what he was doing, because that jeopardizes everybody's life, and because sometimes you could get vertigo, and you wanted somebody sitting there and knew what he was doing. And, so I can see their point of view.
Absolutely. Were there both officers and warrant officers, commissioned officers and warrant officers?
Yes.
Was there a good rapport between the two? Or
I never had any trouble. I did. It's a start. I'm talking about when I first got there. They didn't like the captains we had. We had two, and but I never had any problem with them. One of my letters home, he came in and told us to get out there and clean the beer cans up in front of our hooch. And I remember being mad that we weren't, you know, we were officers and gentlemen, and we weren't supposed to be out there policing up beer cans and cigarette butts, you know. But I guess we did it, or we paid some Vietnamese to go do it. I don't know what happened.
Well, who was responsible for the beer cans and the cigarette butts being out there?
Us.
Okay. And how about the relationship between the warrant officers, commissioned officers, and the enlisted men in the unit? How was that?
They were always saying, don't fraternize with the enlisted men. And I didn't. I'd give them my liquor. We could buy two bottles of liquor each month. And I could just give that to them, and they'd go buy the liquor because I didn't drink hard liquor. And I was their big buddy because they always knew each month I'd give them that deal. And it was sort of like who could brown nose up Carlock's deal, because other guys wouldn't give it to them because they drank the booze, you know. And but I always tried to get along with them. But the relationship was, you know, okay between the warrant officers and the RLOs, we call them, real live officers. There was always some conflict there. They just didn't like our attitude. And you know, a lot of us knew right up front we were not going to be career military. And we joined up to learn how to fly, to be helicopter pilots the rest of our life, which I wasn't. But so that attitude came back and forth. And and there was some, and I got along with a lot of them, you know. So,
but more conflict between the commissioned officers and the warrant officers than between the officers and the enlisted men.
That's correct.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. And what about the relationship between the aviators, crew chiefs, the gunners, the guys flying the missions, and the headquarters echelon, the guys back in the rear, so to speak, the guys supporting the combat operations? Was there much conflict between those two groups?
Not much. As far as the maintenance guys and the radio guys, you had a separate outfit that took care of your radios. You had more conflict with the strap hangers, whatever they called them, that would tell us, you know, these goofy rules where you couldn't fire back until you identified them. And so this stuff worked in cycles over there. They'd come in and they'd restrict us from firing a gun, and then after a while they'd say, just whack away, you know. And there was always conflict in that kind of stuff, just where they'd come up with these goofy rules on when you could fire and when you couldn't fire. Later on, when I left the gun platoon, they came in with this stuff. We were tearing up too many tail rotors. Our door gun bullets, the brass, was going out hitting the tail rotors. So they were trying to change the way we flew our combat missions, and because we're tearing up too many tail rotors. And that was a big deal. And all the fire team leaders, we call it, which were the senior guys, there were three of us, we went over and quit. And to make an interesting story, the very next day they go out and get a helicopter shot down.
Wow.
And
how did that happen?
Oh, several stuff. You know, it depends on who you're talking to as to whether the proper tactics were used mm-hmm. or not. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say they flew into a trap, an aircraft gun trap, knocked down two helicopters, killed 11 or 14 people on one.
Oh, wow.
And as a matter of fact, we're sitting here talking May the 5th.
Mm-hmm.
May the 5th, 1968. That's the first day of the tattoo, they called it.
Mm-hmm.
And Cinco de Mayo and my little friend, he got shot down, got his back broke, and a couple of guys were here at the reunion that were mm-hmm. on that helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And it took us a while to get them out.
Yeah.
They were right in the middle of them, and but it was a trap. But they'd started their moving out. They attacked that night. They attacked all the big bases in Vietnam, just mm-hmm. like they did at Tet, except they didn't have enough men left to really do it like they did then. And
yeah.
But that just happened to be the day they got knocked down. Apparently, I left the gun platoon around May the 3rd, May the 4th, something mm-hmm. like that.
Now, where did these ideas come from? Like, for instance, you mentioned the rules of engagement. You can't engage certain enemy soldiers in these conditions, or we're going to change the way you fly your missions because the brass is hitting the tail rotor. Where did these ideas get generated?
Well, on firing, there's no question, and this happens in any guerrilla war, I think, they would try to get around villages to shoot at us.
Uh-huh.
They wanted us to shoot back.
Uh-huh.
And there was no question. So they would try to shoot at us where you least expected it. They would try to shoot at us approaching our main base
because
mm-hmm. they were trying to get us to shoot back.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they wanted. They wanted mm-hmm. us out there hammering on those villages, that so-called pacified villages. And, you know, we're 19, 20, 23-year-old guys, and, you know, they shoot. We want to shoot back. And, you know, with hindsight, as an adult now, you see, hey, what were they really doing? It's clear what they were doing. They
mm-hmm.
were trying to entice us to shoot up those villages.
Mm-hmm.
And what do? You know, if a guy's shooting automatic at you, you have a little whack him back, you know. And so that was the problem area. You know, when do you fire, when do you not fire?
Mm-hmm.
In my book, Firebirds, I got one in there where R.P. Taylor fired back on a village, and they were going to court-martial him for the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they had full automatic bursts coming out of it, and the rules were a little different. They changed the rules all the time,
mm-hmm.
but they were continually changing
mm-hmm.
through there.
Mm-hmm.
And on the tail rotor stuff, the only thing we could figure was you get a new company commander, and he's told, you go up to that company, and he says, what are you doing? They're tearing up too many tail rotors. I checked the records when I was writing my book, and we were shooting about 3 to 4 times as many bullets as the other companies in the battalion. So logically, we should be tearing up 2 to 3
mm-hmm.
more times. You know, nobody looked at it.
Hmm.
So they come up, and first they change, and some of the door gunners here were talking about it, they started making them shoot their guns upside down. So it kicked the brass a certain way. And that just, all that does is just upset everybody.
Mm-hmm.
They perceive it as they're endangering our lives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some guys that are endangering our lives for a stupid piece of metal, mm-hmm. tail rotor back there. And so that upsets people. And they put all kinds of screens. And what they were saying was, quit breaking off your target so violent. In other words, we'd dive onto the target, the brass hulls are flying out of that helicopter both sides, so when you whip away from your target,
mm-hmm.
your tail rotor is breaking out of the flow, so it's striking into that stream of brass coming
mm-hmm.
out.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're saying, be gentle with the helicopter, and that's the most dangerous time
mm-hmm.
you can have is breaking off the target. We quit. We went in there and quit. Told them we were going to do it.
Wow. Didn't they... There was no idea to maybe create some kind of a deflector or something like that?
They tried to do that. And as a matter of fact, the crew chief said, the new platoon leader, we got a new company commander, new platoon leader at the same time, that he kept saying, y'all go down and build those deflectors. Nobody would do it. And they said he went and did it himself because he had to get it done. And they sort of balked on him.
Wow.
And wouldn't do it. And I vaguely remember what they looked like. And that's what they were trying to do, was build. They built a deflector off the gun at one time, and then they put a screen up outside the helicopter above the weapons systems, trying
mm-hmm.
to hold them off.
Mm-hmm.
And,
did those things work?
I don't know. They didn't stay on long. You might talk to somebody that flew after my time to see how long they kept them on. I don't think they ever kept them on very long because it slowed the helicopter down. Anytime you put wind drag out there, you're slowing the helicopter down and you're straining the helicopter, as a matter of fact. So I don't remember them staying on very long.
Yeah. And there were already chronic problems, weren't there, with underpowering of the aircraft?
I mean, Yeah.
These aircraft did not have the powertrains they needed.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, we were flying 1,100 horsepower in that thing, and with the air hot and thin, it just wasn't. It was dangerous to take off. Before my time, we had one guy taking off hit an anthill, hit it with a skid, and flipped him upside down. And then we had another guy hang a wire, and I think it flipped him or it did some damage to it. And I was amazed no more people didn't hit in the minefields. Because you'd run down to the end, and if you couldn't get it up in the air and it wallowed in the air, you could actually crash in the minefields. And we had a troop carrier that did that, which is an interesting story in our newsletter as to what happened. He had an ammo bunker with 105 shells in it, and they went off for a long time and killed three of them out of four, I guess, and killed some guys on the ground, too. Mm-hmm. But we never had a gunship when I was there actually run through, and that's the reason you want skilled pilots in there, because that's highly skilled, trying to take off in one of those things overloaded, and that's the reason they were objected to us rookies coming straight in there.
Yeah. So what do you remember about Tet 68?
Tet 68, I was what I think one of the few helicopter pilots in the air when that thing started, and I explained that in my book, Firebird. I figured out what happened later on is they attacked, and I've read somewhere why this happened, but they staggered their attacks on different days. Some people say by mistake, or some people said that time change or something. But they attacked up north of us, so we went up to sink their boats. Well, that was one of our missions, was a firefly, we called it. It had a big light in the troop carrier, and they'd spot that on the river and these swamp-looking things, and then we'd jump, come in. You'd keep a gunship with no lights on, you'd run in and shoot them up. And we sunk 93 one night. Well, that night, we didn't sink anything, but they had us up there flying, trying to catch them when they were retreating out, and we just didn't see anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And we turned around and looked down at Chulai, and it's probably 30, 40 miles down there, and it looked like it. We thought they hit us with a nuclear bomb. And I've read later that one guy said he saw that from 60 miles away. And the complete ammo dump went up. They got lucky and put one right in the middle of the ammo dump. And that thing went off. It blew down our bunch of hoochies. My friend Hannah, it was his turn to go after beer. When you're in the bunkers, you took turns over who went after the beer. He was after the beer when it went off, and it blew the fridge over on him. And they gave him a Purple Heart, and then they took it away from him. Once they found out what had happened, they took his Purple Heart away from him. But I remember that, and then I remember we couldn't land. We were up in the air, and we called every place that had refueling capability. And we had different little fire bases around there. They were all under attack. So we landed at a place called Hill 35. And we sat there until they pumped us full of fuel.
Mm-hmm.
And we had I was in a minigun ship, which took a while to rearm it. We must have fired some already. That's what happened. We went down, and there was province capital called Tamki, and we went down there. They just directed us straight down there. We put an attack in because they were up in the perimeter there. And then we went back. We couldn't find a place to land. Went to Hill 35. And years later, I asked my crew chief, I said, how in the world did you load those miniguns that fast? Because they had trays of ammo. You had 6,000-7,000 rounds of ammo in there. And what he did, he loaded them in the air. And I said, what did you do with the cans, the ammo cans? He said, we just threw them out when we got through. You know, we just choked them out the door, you know. And so we went back, put in another strike at Tamki, and my fuel light came on. And I told this guy ahead of me, and he was bold. He was a very bold guy. He got killed his second tour. And I told him, I said, I'm low on fuel. And we knew we were going to have trouble landing again because every place was being attacked. And at Hill 35, we were hitting mortar rounds around us. And so anyway, I remember being in a panic running out of fuel. I was worried about running out of fuel. So years later, when I was writing my book, I called the crew chief up and I said, "What did we do?" And he said, "Well, you dumb shit. You ran it all the way down, and we decided we didn't have enough to get to Chulai. So we landed in Tam Key, and they were shooting across the strip, and we sat down there." He says, and I vaguely remember this, that they stopped firing. Both sides stopped firing. He ran out, and he said he only pumped for about 2 seconds, just enough to get the light to go off. He said he was looking in, and when the light went off, you have at the light, you got like 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he knew 15 minutes gets back to Chulai. And he said, when the light went off, he said, "Go," you know.
Mm-hmm.
Off we went. And he said, the war started again once we took off. And that helicopter got shot up on coming out. And that day had 4 shot up.
Now, who's your crew chief at this point?
Joe Bruce. And my gunner was Mike Aker, who's here. He's missing a leg now. And he's here at the reunion. Joe couldn't make it. Joe's had a stroke and couldn't make it.
Did Mike Aker lose his leg in Vietnam?
He hurt it in Vietnam. He hurt it again right when he got back, and he's worried with 30 years, and I just saw him, and it shocked me. He finally just had him cut it off. He said it just hurt him so darn bad, and he said if he had to do it again, he'd have him cut it off right when he left Vietnam. He said he'd been in pain all these years, and he said he's a lot better off with no leg than he was what he'd lived through all these years.
So Tet 68, pretty active period for your unit.
Yeah, we, at daylight, I went back and got another helicopter and went back, and this is the only time I ever saw North Vietnamese soldiers in the open. And what had happened, the Americans got lucky and put an APC unit in Tam Key, and they were expecting to overrun the Arvin units, the South Vietnamese. And instead, they met some Americans in there with armored personnel carriers. They drove them back in at daylight. We were back up there with 2 gunships, and the Air Force was screaming at us over the radios to get out. They were going to shoot us down because they wanted in there. And we had 500 to 600. They're saying 600 in the open, pulling their wounded. Some of them had 2 wounded. They had one in each hand, dragging them across the open, and we jumped them, and we stayed on them until they shot me all to pieces. A few of them made it into a creek, and they came out of there with full automatic, probably 30 or 40 of them, and they, one of the guys here that's in a wheelchair, Palazzo, he got shot in the butt that day, and he's in a wheelchair, too. He got hurt over there, and that day, he got shot in the butt. He was sitting on an armored plate, and it blew his head up off the ceiling. A 30 cal round knocked him up on the ceiling.
Wow.
And so then we went back, and I got another helicopter, went back up there. And I told this story at our first reunion, and everybody looked at me like I'd lost my mind. But since then, I've talked to 4 or 5 guys, the guy with me, naturally, but an infantry guy. And I said they had a parade coming into town. And the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong were just sure they were going to win that thing right there, which they would have. If the Americans hadn't have been in there, they would have just overran that place in just a few minutes. And they had a parade set up to come in, and I've described it in my book. I dove down on them, and my co-pilot, Hannah, remembers it just like I do. He was the co-pilot. I said, "Put it on hot." And I said, "We start your dive at around 1,000 feet." We're diving down on them, and they had signs and banners stretched. And we were told to shoot them. The guy, the air controller, says, "Shoot them up." And so I go hot, and I said, "Fire." And then I said, "Don't fire." And he remembers that just like I do, because there's kids up in this thing. And I said, "Don't fire." And then I broke off, and I took, I forget how many hits I took. My wingman at that time was a musket. We were out of gunships, so we had another crew, and his name was Gaither. And Gaither, it's not in my book because I couldn't find him. I thought he was dead. And Gaither says he's looking up, and he sees a black mark appear on his windshield. And it's the boot polish off his boot. And my book says he got shot in the foot. They shot him through the foot, and it blew his foot up, and the boot polish put a mark out in front of his eyes. And he said he just remembers there's a black mark in front of me, and I don't know what it is. And it was his foot where it dragged the windshield when it went through. He said they shot his tail rotor off. and he went back to Chulai to make an emergency landing, which I didn't know because I was shot to pieces. He went to one end of the place. I went to the other end, and I got another helicopter and went back out. And apparently, all the senior guys didn't think they'd have a helicopter flying, so they'd already went back to the company area, and I was the only pilot because I didn't want to go back up there. And I went back and got that one shot up. So I had four shot up that day.
Wow.
And so that was my opening experience with Ted. I went back the next day, slept, and then the next day I went to Hawaii and got married.
Wow.
And then I came back after a week, I guess it was a week, and we were still catching them out in the open. They were still catching those units in the open, and we were slaughtering them. I mean, they were boxing them up with these APCs and up against creeks, and then we'd catch them coming across a creek, and it was just like a turkey shoot. And they turkey shot them for like 10 days while I was gone. And then even we were up into February, and I mentioned something in my book, but since then I've had some guys send me some data, and we drew a picture out identical to what happened that day, and it was like 2.5 weeks later we were still catching them, 300 or 400 in a group, and because they couldn't get back in the mountains. They'd moved all these big units out in this flat ground, and you know, they had no chance against us. We out-armed them. They didn't have anything for these helicopters to finish up, much less the jets, once you got them out where you knew where they were. That was the concept, trying to find them, you know. And so any the liberal press that says we got whooped during that time is crazy. And I know, I've heard stories that happened all over Vietnam, just like turkey shoot, you know.
And these were almost exclusively Pavan and not Viet Cong units?
The ones I saw that day had green uniforms on. Now, they argue whether that was a main force unit. I've seen some stuff. I think my book says North Vietnamese. But I've had a guy come in and say they thought that was a main force Viet Cong unit, but at that time there were a lot of North Vietnamese in them. And the ones we call VCs, one had black uniforms on. We didn't know the difference. Anybody had a green uniform, we assumed that was North Vietnamese. So, but I've been told since then they'd mix them. You know, some of the main force units had green uniforms.
So and you could tell the difference when you came up against VC versus Pavan?
Yeah, most of the old VC units couldn't shoot. And, you know, once you box them up, you finish them off pretty good with these helicopters. But you get it against a main force unit, you better watch out. And when I said that, I'm talking about the altitude that you got at. You know, if you were against old farmers, you'd get down there low level. And
How low is low?
10 feet, 15 feet, something like that. And you're not supposed to do that. Your normal attack tactics, our company, was you start 1,000 feet, try to break at 500. But you get up in the mountains, you can't break that thing. And when you do, you got to break it real hard to stay off the side of the mountain, so that automatically lost altitude. So I've been in a lot of them where you'd start at 1,000, go to 5, come back out, try to climb, and after you make a couple of runs, you're down around 100 feet. And that's dangerous when you're going against North Vietnamese unit. And that's where the only thing that saved our lives was the fact that we'd get the helicopter shot up and we didn't have any helicopters to fly.
Wow.
I consider that's probably the only reason most of us are still around here, is you just run out of helicopters. Wasn't anything else to fly, you know. And sometimes in May and in January the 5th, prior to Tet, was a hot time. That's when my friend Anton was captured. And then Tet was January 31st. All three of those time periods there, we just flat run out of helicopters. And every guy, years later, saying, where were you guys at? Well, I can answer that question real fast. We didn't have any helicopters fly. And they actually told us at one time not to come below 1,000 feet. And you couldn't shoot close to the Americans at 1,000 feet. It was just too dangerous to shoot rockets because they were too inaccurate. And because they just changed the rules on us because we didn't have any helicopters, and they knew they needed to keep some flying. And we're talking out of our whole battalion, which would have been 32 gunships, something like four helicopter companies. And so, you know, they changed the rules when you flat ran out of helicopters.
What weapon or weapons did concern you the most as a helicopter pilot, enemy weapons.
Enemy weapons. They did not have the heat-seeking missiles when I was there. Mm-hmm. But it was the old 51 caliber, the 12.7 mm-hmm. anti-aircraft gun. It'd come through a armored plate. It'd knock a transmission out. It'd mm-hmm. cut an engine completely out. The RPGs, they'd shoot those at us quite often, but they were very inaccurate. Now, they would scare the bejesus out of you, especially around dark when you mm-hmm. saw one come by. And I've got a picture of a helicopter. Last day I flew in Vietnam, they hit a helicopter with an RPG. It's unclear whether I was in this flight or they all told me about it. But they hit a helicopter that was in a flight with us, and the cowlings all blew off of it and killed everybody in it. Mm. Then later on, they tried to say it was maybe a grenade that an infantry guy dropped. Mm-hmm. But it was too violent of an explosion. Everybody pretty well agreed it was a B-40 rocket, RPG or something mm-hmm. hit it. Mm-hmm. And some of the guys here were in that flight. And it could be they told me about it, and I just remember, you know, I wouldn't even swear I was in that flight. Mm-hmm. But I'd heard the story so many times about it just choking pieces everywhere, you know, mm-hmm. when it went off.
So the 12.7 was the weapon that concerned you guys the most? Because it could... But the standoff for that, that's more than 1,000 feet, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, even 1,000 to 500 feet, I think it just cuts you up like cutting through butter. So, yeah. No. Later on in Vietnam, the Marines, even at that time, had a deal. They would not come within a click, 1,000 meters, of an anti-aircraft gun. Mm-hmm. We call those anti-aircraft, 12.7s. Mm-hmm. When we were there, we attacked them. When they told us to go get them, the infantry said we wouldn't got them. Later on in Vietnam, they'd only let Cobras attack them. And then I've read later, they said no more. And they'd let jets come in and get them. But when I was there, we had these old Charlie Mile that run about 80 knots, and we were told to go get them. And it was more of an attrition, you know, trying mm-hmm. to keep some of these helicopters flying. Because a 50 hit through one of them, even didn't kill anybody. Mm-hmm. Would put that helicopter on the ground most of the time because it'd tear all kinds of junk out of it. Mm-hmm. And they'd keep that thing on the ground a week or two.
Yeah.
Time to get parts in. You could run one through one and didn't hurt anything, but usually it'd do some. You had to change some structural piece in it. So that's where they finally backed them off later on from them. But we were attacking them when I was there.
What was the most effective weapon that you had at your disposal?
The minigun.
The minigun.
Those rockets, I just thought they were a waste of time. And with that minigun, you cut a tree down. I mean, when I say cut a tree down, you could just shave the limbs out of it, knock the leaves off of it. It did a real trick on them when you mm-hmm. got that thing cooking. And mm-hmm. the key was to keep it shooting. Mm-hmm. You know, it was hard to keep shooting with all that sand and all the dirt you were in, and then the things wearing out. But mm-hmm. if you could get them cranking, they were something. Mm-hmm. You know,
and these are 7.62.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
6,000 rounds a minute. Normal machine guns shoot around 400 to 600. And these things shoot 6,000 rounds a minute. And I've got some pictures around sundown where it looks like a light coming down to the ground, and that's only one out of five bullets. So you had four leads flying, and you had enough tracers coming down, and it looked like a light coming down to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And the infantry catch them up in a tree line or something, unless they had them a hole to dig into the side of something, you just kill them all. You know, there's no way they can escape that when you're running down through there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reason January the 5th, 68, was my buddy Anton was captured. He was the first Army helicopter pilot that was not executed when they caught him.
Wow.
And a guy in my flight class, and they say there's several, that they caught them on the ground alive and they executed them. Early in the tail end of 67.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my buddy that was captured, he said Ho Chi Minh really put that order out around November of 67. We'd heard it was January. Frank Anton was the first Army helicopter pilot captured at one shot.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, before we talk about the circumstances surrounding Frank Anton's getting shot down and everything, I want you to tell the story of your first contact with the enemy.
First contact? They assume you know what's going on, and we were out at, I call them boxing missions. I don't know what they really were, but the infantry, every village generally had a creek or something next to it. very standard, mm-hmm. you know, for water and washing clothes and stuff. So the infantry would get out there and get on three sides and try to push toward that creek, and then anybody that ran, they'd drop leaflets, supposedly, and anybody that ran, you know, you shot them. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, these guys had made it. There was a rice paddy between it, the creek and the little village part. And they ran out there, and you can see them this clear in the mail. There's three of them out there in black shorts. One or two of them had a top on, so you just sticking out like a sore thumb out there. And so we're diving on them, and the lead gunship had already popped over them. And he said, "I've got three in the open." And so Anton hollers at me and says, "Do you see them?" And I said, "Yes." And all this happens in a second or two. We were already down below 1,000 feet at that time. Mm-hmm. And it all happened in a second or two, and boom, we're across them. And I didn't fire because you were supposed to be told to fire. Mm-hmm. Well, his deal was, "Do you see them?" meant shoot them. Mm-hmm. And then McCall came around with his rockets. He had a Hog helicopter, and he blasted these guys, you know, put 15, 20 rockets in there on them. And Anton just raised holy heck, you know, about what a dumb idiot they've given him to be as Peter Pilot. Mm-hmm. How stupid could anybody be? And they used to keep score. And so Anton lost the three kills. And he was really mad that McCall got the kills and he didn't, when he had them lined up and mm-hmm. he was mouthing around mm-hmm. about it, you know. And I caught a lot of crap for a month over that, you know.
Well, you said they used to keep score.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Like big game hunters, like gunfighters. And I never kept score. And
you're talking about kills.
Yes, kills.
Vietnamese people that were
right.
Soldiers.
Yeah. And you know, they had the old body count stuff. Mm-hmm. And but they kept score, and I never kept score. I never paid any attention. And I think participating in that deal with Ted, as far as I know, I don't think any helicopter pilot can say he came as close to getting as many as we got that morning. Mm-hmm. And because I've never heard anybody describe that kind of stuff. And that's mm-hmm. That's in a lot of records that they caught them. And a lot of them could have already been dead. They used to pull the bodies off, too. So a lot of them they were pulling out of there could have been shot. But they were supposedly counting 500-600 bodies out there that morning. So and there were still some alive when we left because mm-hmm. they shot the crap out of me, you know. Mm-hmm. And then the Air Force got there and finished them up, you know. So
How would you confirm body count?
I just guess, you know. I mean, most of the time you knock them down. Sometimes you can see them. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times just a guess. It was a joke, a running joke. One of the guys, I was flying his wing one time, and we shot up this jungle. And the guy on the ground says, how many do you confirm? And we didn't say anything. He said, "Do you confirm five?" And he comes back on the ground and says, "Five monkeys?" And I know the record shows there were five that day. So it was a standard joke about the body counts. Hmm. And come find out, with hindsight, we undercounted. You know, the North Vietnamese now admitting that, you know, we killed 1,400,000, and they're saying even if you take our outlandish body count numbers where they were guessing, that was still less than that. Mm-hmm. And some of that could have been these B-52s that really whacked out big groups of them. But who knows? But it was a standard joke, mm-hmm. and that's how you promoted people. Was off that kind of stuff, and not us. We didn't get promoted off of it, but I'm just talking about company commanders and everybody else. Got, you know, how many kills did your group have? And and that's something they totally did away with during the Iraq War for good reasons, because that incites some people to do things they shouldn't be doing. Mm-hmm. You know, so.
Well, what did you guys think of that strategy? Attrition, body count emphasis?
Oh, we didn't. We didn't think, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was one of those deals. I mean, people might say they did. And, if anybody says that, I think they're using their, you know, 30 years of experience after that. Looking back on it, it was stupid as heck. But back then, we knew we only had a year to do it. We tried to do, you know, the best we could, and we were trained to go do that. So you were looking at it from a one-year timeline. You weren't looking as to what the overall strategy was. You just want to make that year and get out, you know. Mm-hmm. That's the way I perceived it. So.
And that was pretty much shared by your fellow warrant officers?
That's my understanding.
Yeah. And everybody else, as far as the commissioned officers and enlisted too?
Everybody that I, you know, if there was, some of them might tell you they had deeper thoughts at that time, but I never heard anybody say anything. It was that 12 months, let me do this, get out alive, and go protect my friends, and that's basically it. That was the way people viewed that thing.
Okay.
You know, just take care of the guys that you knew, and they'd take care of you, supposedly, and try to make it a year.
But sometimes the guys in the back, the gunner and the crew chief, were they always necessarily looking out for your well-being as aviators or pilots?
No, this guy Foley, he was telling me a story one time. He got this new pilot in, and they didn't like the new guys coming either for good reason.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the new guy couldn't handle it, they got killed. They didn't even have a chance back there. And they could take those guns, and, you know, I told you they tried to make them shoot them upside down to keep the brass from going in the tail rudder. They could turn them the other way and shoot the brass right up on the pilots. And he put quite a few of them down my back. And he was telling a story about how he got this new pilot. This new pilot came in, and he said, I burned him up good. He said they look like ticks hanging off the back of his neck. And that was me. He did that too. So when I got into the back, they didn't like me coming in there. That's exactly one of the greetings I got from the crew guys, because their lives were in danger.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't like it either. Having a guy up there had never flown at night in real-time weather and stuff like that. So they understood it.
Did they understand that perhaps putting a hot brass on the back of your neck might make you a less able pilot at the particular moment in time?
Yeah. to tell the honest truth, you were a little... a little intimidated by these guys. Even the enlisted men, you know, there was a macho swagger there, and that was something you had to have to go do that. You know, how do you get psychologically prepared to go be a gunfighter? I mean, this ain't like a gunfight, you know. And how do you get psyched up for that? So you've got to have this macho attitude. For instance, it just happened an hour ago. Hadn't seen this guy in 32 years, and he's the guy who snapped my picture while we were hiding in a Vietnamese grave. He told me he was scared every day he went out to fly. And so his family's coming down tomorrow, and his two sons, and I said, Aker, I hate doing this. I'm going to tell them that you're not telling the truth. I said, you know, I'm not going to call you a liar in front of your family, but, you know, for you to tell me today that you were afraid, I don't buy that. You know, you never implied anything that lead me to think you were afraid. But it was this macho kind of... as a matter of fact, I didn't want to go to the first reunion because I assumed they all knew that I was scared. Boy, heck, they thought I was some macho guy. You know, I didn't even know that, you know.
Okay. Well, why don't you discuss the circumstances surrounding Frank Anton getting shot down and the events surrounding that?
Yeah, there's... our scheduling was pretty bad. And what's interesting is I've had three guys tell me they were supposed to be with Frank Anton that night. And I've heard it from two of the others, and I thought, you know, that's really strange because I know the real facts. And well, some of the crew remembers this. I was supposed to fly that night. You had standby off at these other fire bases. But I'd been flying all day with this other guy, and they were fixing to make me an aircraft commander. I made aircraft commander and took Frank's place the next day. So they just they technically probably made it at the instant they heard Frank was on the ground. I'll tell that in a minute. But anyway, I was getting out of the helicopter at Hill 3-5, and this guy said, what are you doing? I said, I'm supposed to spend the night up here. He said, you go tell Frank Carson to stay, because they've been sitting up here, and we've been flying all day. So then we get back in the helicopter, but then there's something wrong with one of the helicopters up there, so we have to get out and move all of our gear over to it, so we take it back to Chulai. And that's reading there was a mix of crew. And one of the helicopters up there never flew with McCall, and it was McCall and the crew chief was a guy named Foley that you've talked to. And so they were together, and then Anton and Carson, who I was supposed to have been in there with him, and probably what these other guys are thinking, there probably was a scheduling board back in Chulai that nobody ever saw because we were up at these fire bases. So that could be where there was some truthful dispute in the story, because it could have said that Hannah or Parsons was supposed to have been flying up there, but because they never got up there, they couldn't replace Carson. Mm-hmm. And I just happened to be there, and they told me I was supposed to replace him. And I guess they told me over the radio. But anyway, I go back to Chulai that night, and I don't remember that much more of the story, but this crew chief named Mike Rogers, that was wounded the same day I was wounded, he said they came in and said, we got an aircraft down out there in the valley, we didn't get the crew out. So he and I go down maintenance, and we've got a gunship down there that was in for like a 25-hour inspection or something. We have to look at some stuff. We went ahead and put panels back on it, the cowns on it, and we took off. And he said, you know, I remember that night and the next night. Next night was really bad. The night before, Sutton gets wounded. So we just had guys wounded. We'd been getting shot at big time out there. So Sutton had been wounded the night before, and I was out there that night. So I'd been flying nights for like two nights in a row. And so Roger says, we go out there, we picked up somebody. I'm trying to think who said we picked up. But I was technically a co-pilot, but I'd become an aircraft commander when Anton went down, and I was an aircraft commander the next day. Wow. And so I go out there, we escort a slick in, we got the slick gets shot up real bad. That guy's at our reunion now, and that's about all I remember. I remember very clearly the next night, because we're at Hill 3-5, and we had a 82-millimeter mortar round go off right in front of our tent, blew holes in our tent. We actually ran to the helicopters and are cranking it, and while mortar rounds are hitting around us, and I'm sitting here, and I was a co-pilot, but I swore I was never going to do that again, and I never did it again either. In Vietnam, I never ran to a helicopter when mortar rounds were hitting around me. I just said, that's stupid, and because that's what they were trying to hit with those stinking helicopters. But as far as Frank being down, it put everybody in shock. You know, we just couldn't believe it, and it's really shocking we couldn't get him out, because that's unheard of. And it was a whole combination of factors that overrun an infantry unit out there, and it wouldn't shut the artillery off. And they had the artillery hitting on all circles around the helicopter and around this infantry company, and they could care less about a crew of four people when they had three or four companies on the ground and had already lost everybody in this one company as far as radio contact and all this. And so that crew, they didn't want to hear about them. And they did shut it off a couple of times, let us go in, and each time the helicopter shot up, and they said, we're not going to shut off again. And it was really daylight, and they said it'd wait till daylight, and by then it caught them right at daylight.
Was there anything else that happened as far as contact between Anton and his crew and Ben and your unit, helicopters that were flying overhead? Was there any radio contact or anything?
No. We were real poor. We had some of these survival radios. I do not even remember carrying one. I mean, they say we had one. I've got one as a display item, but I don't remember carrying one of the things. And we were pretty lackadaisical about that stuff, you know. We just never assumed that would happen to us. And like these guys got out of the helicopter with no guns. I think one of them had a sidearm, best of my memory. And you know, they just weren't prepared. You know, like it wasn't going to happen to us. It was pretty amazing.
Did the whole crew survive?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and Carson did something I wouldn't have done. Is I would have stayed with the helicopter. They teach you in flight school, stay with the helicopter. And he escaped and evaded out. And that story's in my book. It's a very good story. And it was in the Army Digest and all kinds of stuff. But we picked him up the next day. And he was in shock and anemic. All the leeches sucked all the blood out of him. And so it took him a while to get going again. Yeah, Frank said that occasionally he'd see us fly over. You know, he could see the firebirds coming over while he was in that camp, and they starved half of them to death and stuff like that. So, pretty rough time. And I could have very easily been in there with him, because I would not have escaped and evaded. You never know what you would do, but I know one thing, I wouldn't have left. I'd have hung around that thing. And
because I knew that was really dangerous. The odds of you getting out after running away from the helicopter is pretty slim.
Mm-hmm.
But they were running some companies the next morning. They were fighting it out in broad daylight out there. I say broad daylight. The clouds were down so low they couldn't get jets in. We got under it the next day, and they shot all of our helicopters up.
Wow.
And this guy wrote a book about it, and he called me, and he said, where were you guys at that day? And I said, I can tell you real easy. We're sitting back at Q Light. We had no helicopters, you know. And we were down to zero in there.
What book and what was the author?
Through the Valley.
Through the Valley?
Through the Valley. A guy named Humphreys wrote it, and it covers what happened on the ground at that time. And in my book, he said, well, I said what happened. They got hit when they were opening Christmas presents. It's January the 5th.
Mm-hmm.
They just had a resupply. And he said, well, technically that's not right. He said, what they really had, they told them to get up and move, and they had all their Christmas presents under their arms. And, you know, one guy told me they were opening presents. You know, good, well, it opened some, you know. Same story.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what unit was this guy in?
No, 196th.
Oh, he's the 196th.
Yeah, 196th, Maracal Division. Yeah. And I don't know what the 3rd or the 21st, don't give me a line, what battalion it was. But Through the Valley is a very good book. And he interviewed all these guys on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And it covers those events in there. And it runs for 2 or 3 days in there. I have another story in my book where this was in April, which was after this time in January there. They had a unit, some kind of recon patrol, got overrun by the guys. They went to sleep. We heard they went to sleep, and this guy called me up, and he said, well, that's technically not right. And I said, well, look, I just said we were told they went to sleep. And he said, well, what really happened, the lieutenant had a hammock. He hung the hammock up, and he went to sleep. And we kept telling him, we need to get out of here. This is bad. This is a bad location, bad stuff. And he says, he's sleeping in his hammock. And that's how that story got to us.
Wow.
You see how the story got in. It was implied to us the whole crew was asleep.
Mm-hmm.
He said, hey, no, man, we knew they were here, you know, and they got wiped out, and that lieutenant got killed.
Yeah.
And he was in his hammock. Pretty cool guy, you know, or stupid.
Mm-hmm.
But that story is covered in Through the Valley, too.
Okay.
Yep.
There's a fine line between stupidity and
being a hero.
Heroism. Yeah.
I've always assumed a lot of heroes are suicidal. Yeah. And just a twinge of being suicidal.
Hmm.
And I've seen some that were just, you call it fearless, and you wonder what else is making that guy tick, you know. And I've seen some pretty cool guys under fire. Not me.
Yeah, I was going to say, what was the most impressive thing you saw?
Most impressive was I was flying slicks, and we saw most impressive thing I ever saw was a convoy get wiped out right in front of us. And we're up flying convoy recon. We'd been 50 feet above these trees, up and down through there. Nothing. Didn't see anything. They got this convoy up in there, and they wiped them out. And the Marines came out. There were some Marines in it. They had tanks. They knocked out Army tank or Marine tanks. And, I mean, it was a full, it only happened a few minutes. And the Marines came out. And their gunships, they had men flying them. They didn't have boys flying them. And they were up so high, I couldn't even find them. And I was an aircraft commander, but I was flying as co-pilot. We'd take turns in that. We're flying with Special Forces then. And this old boy named Casera, he says, I'm fixing to go in there and pick those wounded up. And there's crap flying. There's trucks blowing up. There's artillery shells blowing up in the back of the trucks. And they were calling. They needed some boys taken out. And he said, I'm fixing to go in there and get them. And I said, we can't go in there. And I'd been there quite a while at that time. I said, we can't go in there. And he said, oh, yeah, these boys are going to die. We'll get them. And I'm looking over at him like, and he's supposed to have been here. He couldn't make it. And he went there and picked them up. And a good story, my gunner that got shot in the butt during Ted, he'd been thrown out of the Firebirds, Plazo.
Mm-hmm.
He's on the helicopter that day. Plazo said they're sitting there loading the wounded on there, throwing them in, and crap flying everywhere. And he said he'd shot. We'd been shooting down both sides. We'd been running up and down through there shooting off from the sides of the trucks, just with our door guns. Plazo would just change barrels. The barrels get hot, so you got a glove, and you put the barrel in.
Mm-hmm.
He forgot to pull the lever down to hold it. He says he's sitting there, and he's scared, and they're throwing people on. He looks around, and he sees an NVA step out from behind the hooch with an AK-47. And he says he swings his M60 and he pulls the trigger and it goes poof and a barrel falls off. And he says about that time on Casera we had a brand new H model, 1300 horses of brand new engine, and he snatched that pig and we were gone, you know. And this guy, he burned a whole clip at us and missed us, you know. I think he hit us four times. I believe we took four rounds now, thinking about his and tailbone. And just luck. We got out of there at the right time. But that was impressive. I could, and that guy was really brave. And I got a chapter in my book about him. And,
did the 1,300 horses make that big of a difference?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Part of it is you had new horsepower. You were pulling the real power, where those old 1,100 horses had been wore out.
Okay.
You know, they were just old engines. And what they'd do, they'd run screwdrivers through them. The crew would leave a screwdriver up in the, like the filter. They call them particle separators. And they'd let that screwdriver run back through that engine. What you didn't want to do is run it through while you were flying. And one of the guys here, a slick driver, he was on takeoff, and the screwdriver went through, and you try to get it where it runs through while you're sitting on the ground, and it costs taxpayers $50,000, but that's no big deal, you know, for the danger of having a weak engine.
Yeah, you get that old engine goes away, and you get a
new
1,300 horsepower.
Yeah. And the crew chief, he generally gets an Article 15, so it costs him $50 or $25 or something for not making sure the screwdriver wasn't out there.
But what's sad is they didn't automatically institute a policy where it was obvious they were underpowered.
No, they couldn't.
And so we replaced them. Because
right. So here's the key. You got people that get graded their whole careers depend on how many of those helicopters they can keep flying.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to keep any piece of crap out there they can. We had a hot start one day. And it got so hot it burnt the paint off the cowling that's around it.
Mm-hmm. Could you explain what a hot start is?
A hot start, you got a turbine engine there, and if you overload it with fuel, and it's Frank Anton, the guy who got captured, did it. He got an Article 15. This cost him money. You try to start it, and it doesn't start. It's supposed to wait so many minutes or seconds, I can't remember, and let the fuel drain out. Then you try to start it again. Well, we were scrambled out to go support the infantry, so we tried to start, didn't start. So he just set a few seconds, tried to light it again, and it built up too much fuel in there, and you're getting the turbine's not taking it out the back. It's internally getting this fuel, all this extra fuel all wound up in there, and it's cranking too much heat. It ran past 1,000 degrees centigrade, and that's when I bailed out of the helicopter. When it went to 1,000, you know, vao con dias, I'm out of that thing, you know, and the crew chief took off running. And old Anton's sitting in there trying to shut this thing off, you know, with the engine, you know, smoking and everything else. And so they took that down maintenance, checked it, repainted the cowl and gave it back to us, and I can check the dates in my book there, but it was just a month later or something, the whole engine, the hot end they call it, comes shooting out, and it could have killed all four of us. And that's when the guy took my picture hiding in the Vietnamese grave. It was that engine that the maintenance guy signed off on. And that night at the club, we were taking picks on who's going to get to shoot him. But everybody sort of liked this guy, so we didn't, no retaliation for that. But there was some drunken talk about doing something to this guy for doing that. And but anyway.
Well, speaking of drunken talk and activities, you talk about a monkey in your book, and for some reason I can't remember his name.
Clarence J. Dammit.
Yeah, Clarence Dammit.
I don't know where the J came from, but it was.
Was this one of the only mascots that you had? Or?
Yeah, we had a bunch of dogs.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we had dogs. And as a matter of fact, there's one dog. I was talking to one of the company commanders later on. Apparently, that dog hung around there until we left Vietnam. And everybody liked her. She's nice and friendly and all that. And she had several names. But she was the dog we used to hook the. I've got a picture of her mounted over here. And she's hung under a flare parachute. And we'd take her up, you know, we'd be sitting around on standby, nothing to do. So a slick guy'd come by, a troop carrier, and we'd put the dog in the parachute in and let him go up 1,000 feet, and out she'd go. Then we'd gather her up and then wait for the next troop carrier to come by and let him take her up. You know, that was our entertainment. And
but she didn't mind this?
Well, you know, it could be alleged that she enjoyed it. She would urinate most of the way down, so it's unclear whether she enjoyed it or not. But she didn't fight it, though. A lot of people alleged she enjoyed it.
Hmm.
And but Clarence J. Dammit, they had him out by the club when I first got there, and he was an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
He basically lived off beer, and they had that monkey, and then they had two before I got there. They had Clarence and another one, and they'd moved up from Benoit down south, and heard the story where a guy had a guitar, and they'd packed all their living stuff in these helicopters as full as they could, so this thing was a spider monkey. And they said what happened, though, crew chief looks around and that spider monkey got right up on the middle of that guitar where the hole is in there over the strings and urinated in it. And everybody's dying laughing and the monkey's hanging on the guitar. And Wiegand said before he knew it, that crew chief took the handle on that guitar and threw the guitar and the monkey out. And he said, he looks around and that monkey's hanging on that guitar looking at him like, "My God, don't do this to me." And he says, "Chong, daddy," goes. Before they could stop the crew chief, the guitar and the monkey both went out the door. So when I got there, there was only one monkey left to the two. So.
But how high were they?
Oh, thousands of feet. I'm sure they were running 2,000 or 3,000 feet high. You know.
Quick question about Mr. Palazzo. I noticed downstairs as a photograph, and I think it's of him with a pistol to his head. What's the story behind that?
He says he's going to commit suicide if he ever has to fly with me again.
Really?
I'm the one that got you shot in the butt down there that day, you know. And they were all macho.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you get shot up, then they go back and talk about it and mm-hmm. wonder, you know, was that pilot doing something he wasn't supposed to be doing? And yes, we got down too low.
Mm-hmm.
And that was during Tet, and we got down too low, and we thought there wasn't any fight left in these guys.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, they smoked that helicopter. When I say smoking, I'm talking literally smoked it. They cut some wires in that thing, and that's quite often you smell that burning mm-hmm. smell as mm-hmm. the bullets come through it. I mean, it was smoked up good in that thing. And so he was upset, alleging I got a little too carried away and got too low. And but he beat my buddy, and he hadn't said anything since then.
Mm-hmm.
And then. I tell you, this story's in the book, and I asked him about it at our first reunion because I didn't know what he thought about me. I got a Distinguished Flying Cross for that day,
mm-hmm.
okay? And they gave it to me in about September, right before I left, and they had one of those company deals, which is very rare. I don't know why they did it. Somebody said, "Let's do it," you mm-hmm. know, so they made it, because it's hard to get people together.
Yeah.
Well, Plaza was standing there, and he knew what I got it for because he was out there that day. And I walked by. And he says, "You officers, y'all get all the goddamn medals, and all we do is get shot up or something mm-hmm. to that effect," mm-hmm. you know. And I never forgot that because he was right. You know, they got screwed over big time. And, you know, what he said was the truth, but it embarrassed me.
Mm-hmm.
And even at our first reunion, I dodged him for quite a while because I didn't know what to say to him. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what he was going to say to me.
Mm-hmm.
And finally I walked over and I asked him, I said, "Didn't you get shot in the rump one day?" "Yeah, I was with you, you know." We start shooting the breeze, and it was like, oh, you know, it's a big friendly deal. I didn't know what he was going to say. I thought he might still be offended by that. But I had nothing to do with that. There was somebody else that put me in for that. I think the fire team leader went back and told somebody. And they said, "Yeah, we wrote both of us up for mm-hmm. Distinguished Flying Cross."
And now, speaking of awards, how would the awards for enlisted men be?
Oh, they got screwed up. Most of them didn't even get their air medals.
Why? What's the story behind that?
It's too much trouble to do the paperwork. A lot of them. There's a whole bunch of them sitting out there at this reunion that never got an air medal, and you got them for 25 combat missions and all that, and there's gangs of them sitting out there that never got anything, and that really bothers those guys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we've heard later that there was so much paperwork down in battalion that they just take those and dump them in the trash. And we had guys that should have got, like Casera, I'm sure that day he did the bravest thing I've ever seen, which mm-hmm. could have ranked up with, you know, maybe not a Congressional Medal of Honor. I make a joke about whether he was trying to get a Congressional Medal of Honor or a casket with metal handles, one of the two. But I'm sure he didn't even get a medal for that day.
Wow.
Just nearly positive. And that's just the way the system worked. And then you'd have guys get medals, and I talk about that a little in my book, for just mm-hmm. being the worst mix, you know, mess up you've ever seen. And there's so much fraud in that. In my book, I don't even mention a medal I got. I did say I got a Purple Heart, I think.
Mm-hmm.
but I won't mention the medal. They tried to get me to put that in my book, and I refused to do it as a point of honor, that there was so much fraud in there that I don't even like getting into it.
Wow.
And, I got in trouble over it one time, and that's in the latter part of my book. I was down trying to scratch me another R&R,
mm-hmm.
and I just happened to see a ward for a guy in battalion that, for doing something, got a bunch of our guys hurt and got some people killed, and they were writing him up an award. I go back and I get snookered, and I know who did it, and he denied it years later, and he's passed away with a heart attack. But he says, "Carlock, you're the man that can go do something about this." So I knew I wasn't going to be in the military. I was getting out. I go down and turn him in to the Inspector General. You know, he gave me the Jeep to go turn him in. And, you know, top secret. They're not supposed to say anything to anybody. Mm-hmm. They're supposed to investigate. By the time I got to the company area, they're waiting in the company area for me to go talk to that guy. And it was supposed to be top secret. They weren't supposed to say a word to him until mm-hmm. he checked it out. All they did was report me to the guy I turned in. And he comes down there, and he tried to threaten me with my career in the military, and I made it real clear I wasn't staying in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And that got his attention. And we don't know whatever happened to it.
Wow.
Whether he got that, I'm sure they pulled it back. Because
mm-hmm.
they didn't want to run the risk of me really. And, you know, hindsight, I'd call the congressman, wrote a letter to the congressman.
Mm-hmm.
That's a way to put the fix on them, you know. But,
yeah. Now, who was the commander, the company commander, or the first sergeant at that time when you were serving with the 71st?
Yeah, when I first got there, we had Major Bale, mm-hmm. and then we had Hillhouse, Sergeant Hillhouse. And he ordered us warrant officers around just like we were bug privates, too, which. That's what you had to get anything done. They liked mm-hmm. him to maintain a little order and discipline, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was replaced by Fitzgerald, Major Fitzgerald, who was told to clean up the Tail Rotor Act.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and I don't know how this happened. I don't know. I've heard different stories on why he didn't stay very long. But then another guy named McGinnis that came in at the mm-hmm. end, and I really liked that guy. He was very nice to me. He used mm-hmm. to fly with me occasionally.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was Bell like as a commander?
Well, I tell the story in the book. Clarence J. Dammit mm-hmm. attacked some of our guys. He was a fighting alcoholic, the monkey. So they were drunk, McCall and Wiegand, and they put their army helmets on. They've got boots, underwear, and army helmets. They grab their pistols, and they go to the through the company area going to get him. And they're saying, "Come out, you SOB, we're going to shoot you." So they go back in the company, in the officers' club, and they're sitting there, and Bale comes in. He's got his underwear on, his pistol belt, and he says, "Which one of y'all is going to shoot me?" But he thought they were looking for him. And they were out looking for Clarence J. Dammit.
Were there ever any incidents of threats of fratricide?
No, no. When I said that about the guy in the maintenance deal, I remember us talking about that, but it was a joke. I mean, it wasn't thought about, and there was no serious thought about doing it. People mouthed around. Somebody threw a smoke grenade in Bale's hooch,
mm-hmm.
and he knew who did it. He confronted him at the first reunion. He remembered the enlisted man. He always knew who did it, and he's on our board of directors, and he walked up to him and said, "You're the man that threw that smoke grenade in my hooch, aren't you?" He said, "Yes, sir, and you're the man that shot our pet monkey." And he's the guy that wiped out Clarence J. Dammit.
With a shotgun.
Right.
Okay. Well, what about that incident where you describe in your book you had a gunner that apparently shot entirely too close to the
yes.
aircraft, did some damage to the aircraft.
Right. And we don't know who that guy is. We found most of the guys that served in our unit. We haven't been able to identify him. We maybe know. I knew he's from Kentucky, somewhere up in there. But I knew he was strange when he was telling me about his girlfriend that he had down at Chulai Village, which we did not have a village or a city around us. And all they had down there was one hooker. And the only time I ever went down there, they had a line running out about a half a mile out of it, and that was his girlfriend, okay? So after I heard that, I thought, "This is a strange kid."
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, his machine gun wouldn't work. And they'd already caught vibes. And I didn't know at the time he'd made a threat against one of the pilots.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not to his face, but mm-hmm. to another guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had me stand him at attention. I had only been an officer for like a month. And so they told me to do it, so I went and did it, and I stood him at attention. I told him to get his darn gun clean, didn't want to have any more of that not working, because that's his work. They get out and they can polish that thing down and get it working.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, the very next day, he shoots the door pole out right beside my head. And they're shutting down the helicopter, and I'm sitting there, and I'm looking over there, and I noticed it, and, you know, and I don't even look at him. I just sort of look around like this, and I mean, he just cleaned her out right by my head. Clearly, it was intentional. And he was out of company. Bell moved him out of the company that night. They loaded him up, and he was gone. We never saw him again. And nobody will remember what his name is. And don't know if we'd want him coming to our reunions, but...
I don't know if I'd want to interview him.
Right.
Wow. Any other incidents like that where there was...
When you talk about that, you know, clearly he wasn't trying to hit me. You know, because it's pretty easy to hit you if you mm-hmm. go look at one of those helicopters sitting in that parking lot. All they had to do is turn a couple inches more, and bingo, he had you. Mm-hmm. On a troop carrier, they couldn't turn them inboard.
Oh,
they had those fixed where they mechanically could not turn those inside the helicopter. On ours, they were on straps. They could take it and move it to the other side of the helicopter. Both of them shoot out the same door.
Mm-hmm.
So you run that risk. And he clearly was not trying to hit me. It was just he was going to let me know he didn't appreciate that. Very strange. And that's when they moved him out. So.
Mm-hmm. Now,
but nothing else that I remember. Well, I'll take it back. Hill House, the first sergeant, they had put a grenade under his Jeep. And that happened right when I got there or right before.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that was an intentional deal to get him or not, or just to let him know you need to back off a little bit. But he was one tough hombre. He's passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And we would have certainly had him at our reunion just because everybody sort of admired somebody that's that macho, you know, to take on these clowns, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that did happen. I forgot about that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the only time I heard. And I really don't think that was an intent. I think it's more trying to scare him than do anything else.
Did it work?
No. He stayed after him.
Do you think he was a good first sergeant?
Yeah, you can talk to somebody. Listen, man, I really didn't deal with him that much. From everything I heard, he did the best he could to keep him under control.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got... You know, it's hard to control these guys with these macho attitudes, and that's the reason the peacetime army doesn't tolerate guys like that. And that's
mm-hmm.
the reason the peacetime army can't go fight a war, you know, because you need some of these rogues to, that macho kind of guys, and
mm-hmm.
They don't cut it in a peacetime army, you know, they chunk them out in a minute. And so I thought he tried the best he could with what he had.
Okay. Now, your time with the 71st, you flew exclusively gunships?
No, I flew gunships up until they got into that tail rotor stuff, trying to change
mm-hmm.
their tactics, and we quit. And that was around May. I just happened to be the platoon instructor pilot. So I wound up flying both gunships and slicks back and forth. And I'd run off to the Nang mm-hmm. with the Special Forces, and they'd send a helicopter up there to fetch me back to give some more time and fly with these guys. And what had happened, they were getting them hurt. And then some of them got grounded, RP got grounded for shooting up this so-called friendly village.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's quoted in my book where the guy said you could only shoot back if you had hostile intent coming at you, or that you could clearly see it was hostile intent. And he said just a burst of automatic weapon fire didn't qualify for that. And that really hacked everybody off. You know, some idiot that had never been shot at telling mm-hmm. us an automatic weapon didn't mean anything, you know, and you're riding around in a beer can.
Mm-hmm.
And that heli, other than those armored plates, which were few and far between, you're just riding around in a beer can up there.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, that wasn't good for morale, we'll put it that way. So. But they were continually changing those rules on when you could fire and where
yeah.
you could fire, and trying to keep you away from that where they were shooting from around these friendly villages. And that's what they wanted us to do. They wanted us to tear these villages up.
Hmm. What other major operations did your unit support while you were there, the 71st, as far as you mentioned Tet 2, other major actions or operations that you're a part of?
Yeah, we didn't really know what was going on, okay, mm-hmm. but, you know, they're doing some reading after the fact. They call them different strategies, going clean out different valleys and stuff
mm-hmm.
like that, and I can't remember the names of them now, but
mm-hmm.
we didn't know what they were. You know, all we'd get, if it's really big, we'd get a briefing the night before,
mm-hmm.
and it'd sort of brief us and say, okay, we're going to hit down there at 15 helicopters, we're going to be down there at this time, here's radio freaks, here's who you're going to talk to, here's what we think's out there, and I remember that happening in a year, maybe, you know, I could have been up at the fire base when they gave them, but maybe once a month. And then the rest of the time, they'd schedule you out. A lot of times I would go to bed, when I was flying troop carriers especially, I'd go to bed, then I'd have them wake me up, so I'd go over and find out what I was doing the next morning, then I'd go back to bed. And to know what time you were going to get up, sort of figure out what you were going to do. But they'd wake you up. They had an automatic wake-up. Like if you were leaving, we were laughing about the Army took well good care of you. If you had to be somewhere at 4:30 in the morning, they knew what time to wake you up to get you there. So mm-hmm. each guy got woke up at different times. His crew did, depending on who was doing what. Mm-hmm. But most of the time they didn't even brief us. They'd say, okay, you just fly south down here and you call them on this radio freak and they'll tell you where to go and what to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's probably good enough, you know. What else could they say, you know? They didn't want you too scared, so they wouldn't tell you what was out there anyway. So all you were going to do is move troops, and they didn't even have to tell you where to go. You just followed the lead, you know. Mm-hmm. They didn't even tell you what coordinates you were going to or anything like that, because it wasn't any business. You're supposed to be flying in the flight and mm-hmm. just sort of following along, you know.
So would you brief your crew chief and gunners? Or?
No. Now, you always briefed them on firing, and that's very critical. Before you'd let them, you'd get an affirmative response. I never had a gunner or crew chief fire into the friendlies, mm-hmm. and that did happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I never did, and I was very careful. I said, okay, now, they're down here in this tree line right here. So everybody understand which tree line I'm talking about. We'd orbit out away from them, mm-hmm. back out away, and make sure everybody understood where the Americans were. And I said, now you understand, you do not fire into that position. I'm going to be breaking to the left, or if I'm going to break over them, and make sure they understood you cease firing until we break out of that position. You can fire back over here. And mm-hmm. so you did brief them while you were out here mm-hmm. as to where they shoot, because that's very dangerous.
What friendly fire incidents come to mind when you think of those kind of accidents?
The funniest ones are when we dropped brass on them. We had Americans. One time I had an alert team down, and it was dark and raining and whatnot, and I couldn't see. I was flying lead. I wasn't qualified to be flying lead. I had this gaither that got shot in the foot. And Ted, he was back flying. He was back flying at that time, because this was later than that, and he was... This was after that. It was 3 or 4 months later. And these guys had been shot up. And 2 or 3 of them wounded out of 5 or 6 out there. And this kid was crying over the radio. And he'd shoot a tracer up. And I just couldn't see it. I just couldn't pick it up. So finally, I said, okay, I'm coming down this tree line. I was right above their heads. And I said, you tell me when I'm over you. And so he did that. And when he did, man, we opened up miniguns out in front, tried to scare them.
Mm-hmm.
Let them know we were up there. And he starts screaming and crying, you're shooting us, you're shooting us, you're killing us, you're killing us. And it was our brass falling down on him, because you made 6,000 rounds a minute. That's a lot of brass falling down to the ground. And then earlier on, we went across an APC unit, and I mentioned that. That was Thanksgiving Day, or right around Thanksgiving of 67.
Mm-hmm.
And we dropped brass on those APCs. And some of the crew, as they shot at us, we told them, said, you guys better not be firing at us. They were talking about it. You know, mm-hmm. you're shooting us, you're hitting us, and that's our brass. You better not think about busting a cap on us, but we'll bust one on y'all. And
mm-hmm.
I had a grunt one day coming into LZ Ross. He shot a round through my helicopter. It came right out of the bunker. I saw where it came from. And I was screaming at him over the radio. I know exactly which bunker it is. I'm fixing to blow it away. And old commander, he jumps on that thing and he says, Firebird, Firebird, ceasefire, ceasefire. We'll take care of it. Tell us which bunker it is. Tell us which bunker it is. Because he knew we'd shoot him. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm pleased to get him. I know which bunker it came out of. He said, we'll take care of him. We'll take care of him. I'm sure they told him it was an accidental round or something. But that kid shot at us. And what he was thinking, I don't know. But, we were real low and slow coming in to land refuel. And man, bing, I saw it come out of there. Saw the flash when it came out, went through the tailboat. But
what action did they take, do you know?
I don't know. Never heard anymore. But that commander was sure worried, dude. I was thinking blow that bunker away. Because he knew we didn't jack her out. We'd go for it. That's what they wanted, too.
Yeah. What about actual incidents where there was the accidental killing of friendlies?
Let me think through. I Now, the 198th Infantry, which Schwarzkopf was in later on, General Schwarzkopf, they were notorious for shooting artillery on their guys. I mean, they were just notorious. They, as a matter of fact, they talked about having a stand down to just revamp all their command structure, because they were just blowing. And that movie you see on TV about the Mama friendly fire, that's the 198th Infantry. As a matter of fact, there's a movie, TV really? Movie. It's just from Iowa or somewhere, and Carol Burnett played the mother in the movie, TV movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that was 198th Infantry. And that I don't know if that incident happened, but they were just notorious for it,
mm-hmm.
getting their artillery out of whack and shooting their own guys. And
what about
I saw a short round hit. Ken Wiggin went up and picked up some wounded one day, and that was a short round off one of our artillery things, and something they never tried to do was to move where they had to shoot over the heads of the friendlies, and they had done that. They had penetrated up in the valley, had to shoot over their heads, and short round got in there with them. And I'm sure there's some others that I'm just not thinking of right now. As far as I know, I'm not aware. We had a Firebird rocket hit close to Slick and blew a piece of shrapnel up in one of the guy's arms. I had one when I was flying Slicks. I don't know who shot it. Frank Carson shot it. He denies it. He shot a rocket down there by me, and it blew the door handle off my door on that thing. And the crew, they wrote it up as combat damage, that mm-hmm. somebody shot us from the ground.
Mm-hmm.
I just have this feeling that it was his rocket, because he hit them right out beside us. I mean, it scared the crap out of me, you know, because I knew what it was. I knew it was a rocket that hit, not a mortar round. And, and that door handle was gone, and the crew said that it had to have been a bullet that knocked it off, not a rocket chunk, but who knows. But just having that rocket hit right next to me, and the door handle was gone when I got back in. So.
Wow. Now, when you were on night operations, you didn't have any kind of night vision devices, did you?
Oh, no. We used, and this is in my book, we used what we call the swish-boom method of night navigation. And I explained this to these Apache pilots nowadays. The Firebirds are still in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd get out in those mountains, and when it's raining, you'd lose the horizon. And when you don't have an horizon to look at, then you're in a world of hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw this two times that I remember. And you just turn, and you had a general concept of where the valley leads out of the mountains. You just pop two rockets.
Hmm.
As long as they just kept going, you knew you're right. You pop two rockets and you see them explode, that means you're turning the wrong direction. There's a mountain out there in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the swish boom came from. If you heard the boom, that knew, hey, better watch out, there's something out there.
Mm-hmm.
And they just turn and fire that, and they, you know, just rack them off in pairs. And when you saw them kept going, you knew where the valley was, and shoo, out you went. And I got later where I could fly through the valleys. I knew where I was at the whole time I was out there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was still scary as heck, but those guys on the ground that night here, I was a rookie, shouldn't have been out there. You know, it's complicated trying to tell what to do, you know, how to line up out there in the dark and
mm-hmm.
all this. And that night I flew to the west because I knew where the valley was to get over that mountain. I was down too low, mm-hmm. and I flew west and cut to the right. And I told this guy what I was doing. He said, "You're going west, which is toward the enemy, you know." I said, "Yeah, I know where the valley's at out here, you know." And I brought him out there too.
Wow. What about
that's dangerous, you know. You'll hear a lot of these go drivers, they wouldn't even fly at night, and we're out there putting in tracks out in the rain at night, and pretty dangerous stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was crazy when I first got there, and we had units that would call us when the monkeys would scare them, and they'd be out in that jungle out there, and they'd call us, and we'd go out there, and you know, you're receiving fire, and now we hear movement, we got movement out here. And you know, and after a couple of nights, we'd figure out they were afraid of the monkeys.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'd find something wrong with the helicopters. Anytime that unit called, we'd make them tell us which unit it is and say, "No, we didn't have any helicopters flying tonight." You know, we'd say something to them. You know, endanger our lives to come out there when they're not getting shot at.
Yeah.
Getting shot at, that's one thing. When they just hear noise out there and want us to come out a couple of nights, and we wouldn't go out, you mm-hmm. know, which is rare, but we knew what was going on. You know?
Wow. Well, actually, why don't you go ahead and discuss the circumstances surrounding you getting injured?
Injured?
Yeah.
Wasn't really a lot to it. We were out in, I didn't even know where I was at. It happened December the 3rd of 67, so I got there in September, and we hadn't really flown south that much, and we were flying south in July. And later on, I found out, pretty close to where we're at. And we're putting a strike out there, and there's some infantry guys already on the ground. We were inserting troops. And we took an anti-aircraft round up through the rocket pod, set a rocket off, exploded it, and it blew the oil cooler off the engine. Engine was technically still running. It wasn't going to run long, but it blew the whole side off. And the gunner, I was pretty sure that he was dead. I'd never seen anything like that. And we hit the ground on a dike, and I jumped out, went down the skid. It was rainy season, there was mud and water and the thing, and the dike was pretty wide, and the belly was down on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I grabbed him out of the back, because you always think about it exploding. You assume the helicopter's going to explode. So I grabbed this guy named Fox, and Rogers was in there that's at our reunion here. Mm-hmm. He was the crew chief. He wasn't hurt as bad. He was in the hospital like a month. But old Fox was smoking, and it was the smoke off the fire, or the flash of the rocket or something, and I saw his foot was nearly gone. It looked to me like it was gone. So I threw him over my shoulder and stepped back away from the helicopter. And when I did, I buried up in the mud right up to my mid-thighs. And I just stood there. I couldn't move. So then Wiegand, our wingman, he comes in to pick us up. And McCall apparently got a radio call off. He was hurt too, the gunner was hurt bad. And Wiegand, he's sitting on that dike there screaming. You can see his mouth moving because he was getting shot at. And I was on the side away from the enemy and down in the mud and was sort of using Fox, the gunner, as a shield. I'd moved him over. And Wiegand's mouthing me, motioning for me to come over there. And it dawns on him, I can't move.
Mm-hmm.
And before he'd get a crew guy out, an infantry guy broke out of the woods, apparently a medic.
Mm-hmm.
And he broke out of that woods, and I mean, he was running. And he just scooped by me, and he grabbed that guy and threw him in Wiegand's helicopter, and he took off. He knew he was hurt bad. And then the guy comes back to me, and he cuts my shirt off. I had a brand new shirt. I just got it, a fatigue shirt. And he cuts the sleeve out of that thing, looks at my wound, and just sort of snickers, and off he goes. And I had one drop of blood come out. And then years later, we tried to chase this. His name was Carl Fox, and I talked to him on the phone. Finally, I asked him, I said, well, Carl, you still got your legs? He said, yeah, they work good.
That's good.
He was in the hospital a long time. Mm-hmm. He's got some real problems, mental and physical problems all over, because he had shrapnel all over him. But his legs and foot were the thing that really hurt, but he said he walked around pretty good on it. So.
Okay. Now, did you have much opportunity to work in support of Arvin units?
A little bit. Oh, when I say that, I worked early on, but when I became a slick driver, I flew for like a month with it was either the 5th Regiment of the 2nd Division or the 2nd Regiment of the 5th Division. Can't remember which one. It's in my book, but I can't remember which one it was. But it was one of those, and I flew with them for like a month. It's quite an experience.
What did you think of Arvin?
Terrible. When Americans sweep a valley, just in the nature, even draftees, guys that don't care, they put them on line and sweep a valley. Take Arvin, sweep a valley, ants crawling across there. They're just one line, they're sweeping it 3 foot wide, and their commander's riding on my helicopter, and he's screaming over the radio at them to scatter them out and all that, and they just won't do it. There was an attitude in there, and you didn't see that with the Viet Cong or the NVA, and whether it's leadership, training, corruption, graft, I don't have a clue, but when I saw that, I was shocked. I couldn't, it was just the nature. They didn't want to get hurt, and they knew if they walked down that main little dike, one dike across this big valley, and they were just going down that one dike like a stream of ants headed down through there, and that was them sweeping the valley, and naturally they had no contact. They could move into areas where we'd go out there and we'd get in a fight in 10 minutes, and they'd move in an area and they'd sit out there and they'd be fishing and, cooking and stuff like that. They wouldn't fight each other. So.
Wow.
That's all right.
What about other country forces? Did you get to work with, say, Korean or Australian or?
No, the Koreans were close to us, and I really had no dealings with them. But the Australians were around. Mm-hmm. They were at some of the Special Forces camps around south of us. Mm-hmm. But I really had no dealings with them. I dealt with some of their. They had bombers over there, Canterbury bombers. Mm-hmm. And I remember one day out there talking to some of them, and we were on the same mission together, a sniffer mission they called them.
What was that? What's a sniffer mission?
That's a machine that pick up. It wasn't heat. It was urine smells and smoke. And I don't know exactly how it worked. And it was debated whether that worked or not. But some of our guys swore that it worked, that they'd actually ask this guy. They'd fly him over water buffalo, and they'd ask him, did you get a spot? And he'd pick it up. And but I always assumed it never worked. But that's what you do. You put one helicopter down low, and you'd fly along low level with that thing.
Mm-hmm.
Had two guns behind it, two gunships. Mm-hmm. And they were down low trying to follow. And then you had one troop carrier, Slick, up top, and he's directing them on the ground. And then you had two Phantom jets or Canterbury bombers, or you said somebody hot to go ahead and hit them right there on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd pick up a good strike. They'd let the Firebirds, the gunships, work them over. If mm-hmm. something really hot, they'd go ahead and pull the gunships out. All they're supposed to do is just escort and protect the troop carrier.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'd bring in the bombers and do a trick on them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we flew those a lot. And, you know, based on the body count, apparently it worked. You know, mm-hmm. we never knew. I mean, you're striking jungle that you mm-hmm. can't even see into, and apparently we were getting a bunch of them.
Mm-hmm.
And, but that was dangerous because that's the concept that fly you up in these dead-end valleys because the guy's just reading the map up top, talking to you on the radio, watching you on the ground, trying to tell you which way to turn.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't following the elevation, he'd turn you up in a draw, and you'd look up and it's 200 feet upside of a cliff, and
You
don't have enough power to crawl over it, and the troop carrier could get up over most of it, where mm-hmm. the gunships didn't have a chance. And they'd either have to get out of that valley, or I've been on both ends of that deal. I've mm-hmm. had it happen both ways, you mm-hmm. know. Nearly get killed up in those things. And but I've been out in, you knew when you went into Laos, because you'd fly about 45 minutes west of July, and you're in Laos. And I've seen, I always like looking down, and you're keeping your eyes ahead, and then you're trying to look down and see what you can see. And I saw metal bridges out there. I saw a French villa built on the side of a mountain once. I saw stretchers with bandages laid out on them. It was fascinating to see what mm-hmm. you can see. And a lot of trips, you take a trip after trip and never see anything. Mm-hmm. Nothing but green jungle.
Mm-hmm.
But you'd actually see junk out there flying. We were low level. You're flying, you know, 2 or 3 feet above the trees, and occasionally even that junk you could see down.
Yeah.
You'd see something. And, you know.
Why would you fly into Laos?
Because they told us to. But in my book, I explained, I wrote home and I told my parents, I said, I've heard they're sending these guys into Laos now, and that was earlier than that, and we always assume we're in Laos, but we didn't have maps.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we didn't have maps that even went as far as we went, and they just tell us, you just keep flying this direction. But we heard they were inserting troops over there and all kinds of stuff, and I swore that I wasn't, because it was a neutral country. I said, mm-hmm. I'll be court-martialed before I go in there. Well, it wasn't about a month later, I was flying into Laos with Special Forces, you know.
Uh-huh. Wow.
So you sort of did what they told you to, you know. So.
Yeah. And what about Vietnamese civilians? How much interaction did you have with them?
None. We just had a few hooch maids that worked around the club, and mm-hmm. then they'd fill sandbags for us. And but that was basically it.
Any problems with them?
No, you had the cultural problems. Where we were at, there wasn't much water. That's the reason it wasn't a town there. It was a little village there, but they didn't have any water.
Mm-hmm.
And during the rainy season, it'd flood around there. But they couldn't take baths, so they had a smell that was terrible. And that caused cultural, whatever you want to call it, that we looked down on them. There's no question about that. Mm-hmm. But, the reason was there wasn't even water there for them to take a bath. And
mm-hmm.
We would catch them in the creeks. The young girls.
These were the PL missions, is that right?
Yeah, yeah. And the young girls would, they'd always try to take a bath. And not this was out from July where you had some actual creeks.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd always try to bathe around sundown. And that's the time if we hadn't flown much that day, we'd like to get up and test everything out. So we'd mm-hmm. go out and we We call them P&L missions, peep and lust. Mm-hmm. And we'd chase little babes around. Pretty tacky.
How old were you then again?
About 20.
Yeah? Yeah. So, understandable. What about other potential problems in the unit? Things like drugs and racial tension, stuff like that?
No. We didn't have that many blacks in there. I just heard a story a minute ago, and I guess I could relay that story, but I just heard it. And drugs, they say my guy that got wounded, Fox, the day I got wounded, I was from the country, and they said he used to come up. He was from New York, and he was one of McNamara's 100,000, by the way, and which is very rare, but they brought in 100,000 that couldn't pass the IQ test, and he still worries over that graded him as being dumb.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember some of them. I didn't remember him smoking. I thought, well, these guys are so broke they can't afford cigarettes, because they had homemade cigarettes. And they said Fox used to get up in my face and blow marijuana smoke in my face, and he'd go back and laugh, and he'd say, that hillbilly from Texas doesn't have a clue what I'm blowing in his face, you know. And I don't remember that per se, but I remember him coming up with these homemade cigarettes. And but other than that, I didn't even know what marijuana was, and they started giving us lessons. Mm-hmm. And apparently it got real bad later in the war. But as far as I know, I think we had a night operator that ran the radios at night.
Mm-hmm.
That something about a scab on his face, and he'd lift that scab up and put, that's how they caught him. He'd put his heroin or whatever it was under that scab, and then push the scab back down. It kept getting bigger and bigger. And they finally took him down. They knew something was wrong. They took him down, and I do remember that.
Mm-hmm.
As far as racial tensions, we had one black pilot that came later to the company. We had one there that was there nearly the whole time I was, and he was a very brave guy. And did as a matter of fact, he rescued. There's a book out written by Liz Trotta, and she was one of the first female reporters there. And it's called Fighting for Air, and it was to deal with her being a reporter, but it talks about Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And she talks about a helicopter crew getting killed in front of her, and she's got a film of it. And I got this briefly in my book, and this guy said he's watching TV one night, and he saw that film, and he thought, my God, that looks familiar, and it was him. And he crashed. They shot him down. He crashed over the side of this Special Forces camp, and Rex Robertson, the black guy, they got a film of him coming in, rescuing him.
Wow.
And Liz Trotta thought he was coming to get her, but he wasn't. He was coming to get Erickson, who was in the back, and she said that crew got killed. Her book says they were killed as it crashed over the side. Well, they didn't die. They came out of the helicopter and ran back up the perimeter and came right around, and they got on the helicopter with her. They were on the same helicopter she was, and Rex, the black pilot, was the one flying it. And there were mortar rounds hitting around it and all kinds of stuff.
Wait, this reporter... The aircraft she got out on had the crew of the aircraft that crashed.
And she thought they got killed.
Reports in her book that they got killed.
Yes, and we talked to her. And she wrote the blurb on my book. She said, yeah, guys got home, but she was told, and she saw the helicopter go right over the side, and they knocked his tail rotor off with a mortar round. Apparently he was spinning when he went over the side.
Yeah.
And so he crashes over the side, and she was just told they died. Instead, they beat feet right up the side of the deal. They come back around with her, and they're right behind her getting on Rex's helicopter.
Didn't she interview the guys that were on the helicopter with her?
Apparently they didn't have time. I'm sure they didn't talk, you know. I'm sure everybody was just glad to get out of this place, and I know where it was. I covered it in my book. It was a Special Forces camp that was laid in the main flow where the enemy used to come into Da Nang. Mm-hmm. It was out west Da Nang, and it was a real hot area out there. I knew I got killed out there a lot of times. But that was the story of Rex, and he got his helmet cord shot off one day, and he and I were pretty good friends. And he won't come to the reunion. We don't know if he felt discriminated against. No telling what some people said to him. You know, mm-hmm. I don't have a clue. He never said anything to me, but he used to drink out to bar with us and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
But I heard one of my crews saying down a while ago, and I'd never heard this before, that one of the black pilots, and I think it was the other one that came later, named Suber, and he's died in a crash since then, I've heard. He came over and told them to quiet down their music. He was trying to sleep. and they said, you go over and quiet down the Black Hooch. All the black enlisted men lived in the Hooch by themselves. And he said, you go tell them turn the razors off. So anyway, they put shoe polish on their face and walking around and said, now we've got us a Black Hooch and we can run our music as loud as we want to. Just heard that a few minutes ago.
So you didn't witness that yourself?
No, I never even heard it until 32 years later.
Wow.
And so that was the only time. And the crew said that was the only racial end. We had black crew chiefs, like Anton got captured, black crew chief. Lewis was the crew chief on that. And we never had any problem that I'm aware of. They all rode in a truck together because you're getting killed together, or nearly getting killed together, so there was no... I saw no problems. The the real combat units, like the AmeriCal Division 196, I went to their reunion a year or two ago, and they had blacks and Puerto Ricans. I went there, was about a third Puerto Ricans, third blacks, third whites, and they were all in there dragging, raising heck together. Puerto Ricans couldn't even speak English. And there wasn't a Puerto Rican there that didn't have a picture of a Firebird helicopter. Every one of them came out there the next day, and they, you know, it was daylight, and they saw the helicopter. They all had a picture of one of them, you know, because we'd bailed them out so many times. They were out there laughing about it. All that. They came all the way from Puerto Rico for that reunion. I was amazed how many of them showed up. After all those years, you know. So.
Now, you mentioned in your book a lot of drinking.
Yeah.
So when I say drugs, I guess maybe we should also include alcohol in there as a coping mechanism. Was that pretty prevalent in your unit?
I would say, you know, it's easy to say, some of these phonies out here drawing this money from the government and all this. Our fear was a temporary kind of deal. You know, you spend a night out there and you're afraid all night long that somebody's going to get you, where in our outfit it was stark terror for a few minutes, and then, you know, it's not too long longer and you're back at the club drinking beer laughing about it. And so it's hard for us to judge, you know, what really happened to those guys that had to stay out there. Now, these phonies that sit around these bases and sit there and say, Vietnam made me crazy, that's a bunch of hooey, you know. If anybody's going to be crazy, it's those frontline guys out there, and there were very few of them. And I ran into a bunch of them. That was the first big grunt reunion I went to, and there wasn't many crazies there. You know, they were just average old schmucks, you know, just average guys. And they were the frontline guys, none of that phony baloney stuff. But we really shouldn't be judging them from our perspective, because our terror was a little different.
Yeah.
It was a stark terror. And then, you know, 10, 15 minutes later, you're sitting on the ground laughing about it. You know, like, holy smoke, look what happened, you know. So it's a different kind of fear.
What other ways did you and your fellow aviators cope with the stress?
This macho kind of stuff. You get to the club and go to sing. I had a guy come up and give me the words to a whole bunch of these songs that we sang. And I hadn't had a chance to look at it, but we had all different kinds of songs. You know, you know, you get drunk and you start singing that. Let's see. Drop the napalm in the schoolyards. Watch the kiddies run and shout. You'll really laugh your butt off when they try to put it out. You know, you wonder about songs like that. Like, what in the heck's that mean? Well, it's getting you immune to any kind of feelings. It was just like, as a, you know, hey, they're coming after me, I'm going after them. And it's the same concept being a gunfighter, or probably to get somebody to really shoot at the enemy, you've got to really get them psyched up. And I know the infantry guys did that too. Like, you've got to get them psyched up. Average guy won't go out and shoot at somebody, you know. And so you've got to do a special kind of training, and that kind of macho kind of stuff is what, that swagger kind of stuff. And some people did it, and that's the reason they didn't like us coming to the gun platoon, because they didn't know what we were like. And apparently they thought I was pretty macho, but who knows? I was not macho, for sure.
So, I guess we should probably turn to the question of strategy and what we were trying to accomplish in Vietnam. And your response to that question, what was your evaluation of the American strategy employed during the war? Idiotic. I was wondering if you'd elaborate a little bit. What do you mean?
This concept of search and destroy. You can go read. I've read probably as many books on the Germans fighting the Russians in World War II as anybody around. And they had the very same problems of fighting around these forests and these swamps and stuff in Russia. And you just can't do it. You can't go in there and try to root them out and swap them man for man, you know, and that's what it was getting down to. You know, most of the contact over there that I witnessed were ambushes. And these guys are just walking. They're tired. You wouldn't believe some of these guys how tired they are. Dragging those, they'd have those stinking packs on their back after walking in that temperature. They used to have me, I've got a picture where this guy took them out some food and water and some socks, and he asked me if I would hover my helicopter to cool them off while they were changing their socks, and I took a picture of it.
Wow.
And I told him, I said, let me tell you something, and they were covered top to bottom, just soaking wet, and I said, you get me shot and I'm going to be plenty mad. He said, oh, don't worry, there's not anybody around here, we're just going to sit down and change our socks, you know, cool us off a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the concept. You can't fight when you're that tired and that hot.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like using them for booby traps or bait, throwing bait out there. And, you know, the Germans finally figured out they're better off putting a little, you know, perimeter out here of different little units,
mm-hmm.
have a backup unit behind them, and once they hit one of them before they can do much damage, bingo, you throw the big stuff at them and overrun them. And you let them come at you. You don't go after them, and especially in that kind of terrain. It's stupid, bizarre, idiotic. And it was this body count stuff. That guy was there for a year. They weren't even there for a year. Most of the commanders were there for, like, we had three company commanders in a year, and the infantry guys 6 months at the most is what I've heard out in the field. And they were in there, and how do you grade a guy in 6 months? Body count. And that's all he wanted. And they didn't really count the guys against him unless he got his whole unit wiped out. So it's really body count on the other side. You get a few guys hurt. As long as you don't get them slaughtered, you're okay. And it's just crazy, bizarre, if you ask me. And all I had to do is read a history book. You read about the French, read about the Germans. Germans had the same exact thing in World War II. And they figured out they couldn't get up in there with them. There's just no way you could do it. You get in that kind of terrain, it's just ambush city, and they'd lose whole units. People didn't realize they'd have to have 100 men out, all 100 disappear. You know, go up those that pit part, whatever the big swamp is, it covers about the size of Germany up in Russia, and they'd try to root them out there, and they just couldn't do it. And so to me, anybody that had a lick of sense could have read a history book and figured out you couldn't fight the way they were fighting. And it was this short-term kind of nature. You're just grading a guy on 6 months' worth of stuff. And the only thing you do is let him guess how many he'd killed, which is crazy. And the Army was smart enough to get rid of that. They would not tell you how many they killed in Iraq. And I know why. They're never going back to that as long as you got some of these old Vietnam vets around. They'll probably go back to it the next time they get in some kind of brush war. Who knows? But people get too smart to follow a history book. You know, history doesn't mean anything because we're a smarter generation, and it's all the same. You know, it doesn't care what happens. You know, but so that's my views on their tactics, and it was outrageous. And I saw the Marines. Oliver North was. I met him a couple of times, and he was going to put a blurb on the book until he read what I said about the Marines. I saw them get online just like they did in the Civil War, except instead of being shoulder to shoulder, they'd put about 5 yards between them, which sort of compensates for a machine gun going at you, and they did the same thing. I'd see them sweep a tree line. They knew the enemy was there, and they'd go straight at them. And I'd fly over. When I was flying Special Forces, the Marines were all around there. And somebody was fixing to get killed. I mean, you'd sit there and you'd watch it, and you knew somebody was fixing to get killed right there before your eyes. And we'd try to get back around there and watch, you know, because, like, holy smokes, look at these guys. And they had those kids trained where they just get on, they call it getting on line and go at them, you know, and it's crazy. They should have lined up the commanders and shot them all, the way I look at it.
Did you see, did you and your fellow officers talk about that type of stuff in Vietnam? How the strategy just didn't seem to make sense, or?
No. I saw some stupidity. I knew, maybe we did talk, I don't remember having a lot of conversations on it, but like, I'll tell you another one, is they had a tendency, they knew where the artillery was set up. These these people were smart people, and anybody that was fighting us would have to figure this out real quick. There's certain places they can't drop artillery in from the existing places. They shoot her up, and if you got a mountain with the right kind of slope to it, you can't get it to hit on the other side of the thing if you're far enough out. The artillery's too far away. So that's where they fill their little base camps. And I talk about one time in my book where a wounded black guy grabbed my arm in the helicopter. And I just went in there and got him out. And it was a scary deal. And he was in the back, and he reached up and grabbed my arm, and it scares the crap out of me. You know, because nobody's supposed to be touching you. Not that I cared. It's just the fact that nobody's supposed to touch you, and the arm grabs you, and you think, holy smokes, what happened? You were shaking. It was so deal. But that was one, and I don't even know if that's in my book. That's one where they got up in there, and they couldn't get artillery to them. And I figured that out myself. I'm 21 years old. I said, that damn unit, they can't get artillery in there to them. And what happened, they should have picked that artillery up at Chinooks and moved it where they could have shot up into that area. So they put some rounds up in there, but they couldn't get to it. And had Americans up in there in that triple canopy jungle and just got them, you know, I say slaughtered. I hauled out a load and somebody else took out another load. And that load I took out, I had a new H model. And I bet I had 9 to 10 on that thing, wounded on that thing. And I know another one came in behind me to pick up a load, too. So,
what did the soldier grab your arm for?
I don't know. Yeah, I'm sure he was morphined up. And whether he was trying to say thank you or say nothing, I don't know. All I know is it scared the hell out of me.
Because you have both hands.
On the control. I just given the controls over to the co-pilot. I just got out, and I said, take the controls, and I just put my arm down, and I was trying to stop shaking, and the next hand, I'm kind of grasped my arm. I was like, yeah. Out of the seat I was going, you know, so I had straps on. So, but I'll never forget that day.
So when did you leave Vietnam?
September of 68, and we went down and flew a combat assault, and me and this old boy, we stopped down. I'll tell you the story of the last day I flew. We stopped down at this other company. It's called the Minuteman. That's where my buddy Gaither was. He got shot in the foot in Tet. He was a musket down there with them, Minuteman and a musket. Muskets. And anyway, we landed down there first. For some reason, they told us to go down there. And we're going to do a big combat assault. And I'm sure Colin Powell was out here this day. Nearly positive. He was with the 11th Brigade at that time. And then he moved up to AmeriCal headquarters. And it was 11th Brigade we were supporting. And anyway, I asked where my buddy Connors was. And they said, oh, he's in the Hood Sleep. He doesn't fly anymore. And me and Dillard went to Vietnam the same day he did. So we wanted to not fly ourselves. So we're sitting there talking, and this company's already let them quit flying, and we had 10 or 12 days to go, or maybe 15 days, I don't remember, but we were getting close. And so anyway, the story was they sent out 15 guys or 30 guys, I can't remember, and they lost radio contact with them. They assumed they would all been shot and killed. But we were going in no fire. 15 helicopters going to land out here where they'd lost these people, weren't going to fire around. Okay, now, right off the bat, old boy's been around a lot of while like me. We're not liking this. And so anyway, we're heading, we run down to Quang Nine, we pick up some Merriman, and we're heading out down this river. And the crew chief says, look down at the riverbank, and let me see, we got a gunship laying down on the riverbank, smoking. So then we start our turn. We're going up back to the north, and we're going to turn, come back into the south. And they actually told us which way we're coming in. And they were waiting on us. You know, in the Arvin, we're in an Arvin area, so they knew we were coming. Okay, because they had to clear it through the Arvin down there. Now, where we were at further north, we didn't have to clear anything with them. But down in that area, Quang, now that was division headquarters, an Arvin division in there. And they knew we were coming. And then we turn and we're coming along there, and somebody in the flight says, look down there, and there's a H, we call them 13s, an old bale bubble job. It's laying down there burning. They already knocked down two, just people out there sort of snooping around, you know. So we turn final, no fire. We're sitting down, and a machine gun goes off, and I turned my head, and I said, cease fire. I thought it was my guy. I'd already told him not to fire. That machine gun was that close, he took the helicopter head up. He's right outside my door. I broke out. I was telling Charlie, because I was the most senior guy, got at the end. You could get where you wanted in the flights. And a lot of guys wanted up front. I wanted them back. I just took that helicopter, man, I just went out of that thing sideways, man. I chung out, I went, and kicked her out, and I didn't give a rip what they said. Machine gun sitting right there beside me. And I forget the numbers that's in my book. I found how many got shot up. I don't know how many guys got killed that day. And me and old Dillard, we go back to the company area, and they were trying to get us to go somewhere else. We still had some flying time left in the day, and me and Moose, we just went in, and we called him Moose Dillard. So we just went in and landed. Both of us did. We shut down, and I said, "Are you going to quit with me?" And he said, "Yeah." So we went there and told the company commander. We just went straight to the company commander, and we told him, said, "We quit." He said, "You can't quit." He said, "Sir, we're not going to fly again. That's it. They make us fly in these LZs with no prep." We called it prep. Mm-hmm. They don't bomb it. They don't do artillery. Mm-hmm. I said, "The idiot did that. We're not going to do it again." And he looked at us a minute, and he sort of liked me. I got along with him. And he says, "Okay, I'm going to send you down Cameron Bay and pick up a new helicopter." And he took two senior aircraft commanders and let us go boondoggle the rest of our career in Vietnam. And we spent 5 days, I think. Should have been back the next day, and we were gone 5 days. And he met us at the flight line, and he was mad. And he said, "You should have had the courtesy of sending word to me," because he was afraid if we'd went down somewhere that would have been on the ground out there, he had been in trouble, and he was going to have to go through the big chain. Mm-hmm. And we did get word to him out of one place. Somebody was headed north, and we said, "Call him when you go by." And he had heard from us out there about the third day. And we'd sent word, but had maintenance problems. And we'd drink. We'd stop and drink at every place. We had buddies at every place. Mm-hmm. You know? We'd land, and I said, "How long are we going to stay here, Moose?" And he said, "All night, man. I got a good buddy here, you know." So we drank all night with those guys and get up next morning and fly about 10 miles up the beach and spend a few hours and then go up the next beach, you know, the next place. So.
Well, speaking of entertainment and stuff like that, what about R&Rs?
What happened, right after that Tet offensive that day, I went to Hawaii and got married. Mm-hmm. And then later on, that's sort of what got me in trouble. I mentioned that story about these medals. Mm-hmm. I went down to get me another R&R, which I got one. I went down there to get it. The guy promised me one. Then I went and turned that guy in for that phony medal. Mm-hmm. That's where I was at. It was laying in his office, and I wasn't supposed to be reading it. They took it away from me. Then I was flying with Special Forces, and the colonel out of the 5th Special Forces up there sent word to me. He says, "You boys are doing a good job." And I sent word back to this sergeant or somebody. I said, "Could he give me an R&R to Hawaii to see my wife?" And the 5th Special Forces arranged it, and then I had to clear it with my platoon leader down, and he snuck me out. There were no more second R&Rs, and my platoon leader down there snuck me out, and he passed away with a heart attack not too long ago. And he was a captain, and everybody liked him.
What is his name?
His name was Castle. Captain Castle, Herman Castle, and I never got to lay an eye on him. I talked to him on the phone 100 times, and he was coming to our reunion, died of a heart attack. He was the guy that got me out, because I came down and I had all the paperwork done. I said, "In some way you can sneak me out of here." "Carl, I'll cover for you. Get going." You know? But Field Special Forces is who really got it for me.
Now, when you say you worked with Special Forces, you were still in 71st,
yes,
just acting in support,
right,
of the Special Forces.
We kept two helicopters sitting at Da Nang all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And when one would go down for maintenance or something, they'd send another one up and replace it. And then if a pilot wanted to stay up there,
mm-hmm,
generally all you had to do is ask. There wasn't... Some people considered it dangerous, and some people thought, "Well, I'd rather live up here." We had a French villa with a flush commode and air conditioning, and it's like going to heaven compared to where we were at. So mm-hmm, we sort of liked it. They fed us good and treated us like kings, man. They loved us. And, you know, we'd go in the bar, everything was free.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it didn't cost anything to get drunk anyway, but at least they'd serve free stuff to us, you know, and because we were their guys, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They had to count on us. And so I enjoyed going up there just to get away from the company here and all the different stuff, you know.
What kind of operations would you... would you support them on? Was this primarily as gunship or also
no,
troop
this
carriers?
Is troop carriers. This is troop carriers.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the mission, there was really two camps up there. You had real sneaky Pete's,
mm-hmm,
and then you had the guys that run the Special Forces camps.
Mm-hmm.
And we were at the Special Forces camp guys, and then when the sneaky Pete's, and I forget what they were called, but they were right next to each other, when they need somebody, they'd just grab us across too.
Mm-hmm.
And they were running... helicopter unit out of Da Nang was supporting them, but they actually used Arvin helicopters, some. And but anyway, we get snatched over there. But most of the time, we were just supporting into the different Special Forces camps. And there were like I could count them off here if mm-hmm. I wanted to, but six or seven mm-hmm. that we'd support into. And then those guys, if they could scrounge us with time, and they'd say, you know, they'd call in and say, can we have this helicopter 4 hours or 3 hours? We want to go out here with them too. We'd actually do insertions with them.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd keep us, and we'd actually do, and that was dangerous because it's single ship stuff. And when it really got dangerous, then we'd demand two helicopters. Mm-hmm. One guy to go pick that guy up in case something happened. But a single ship out in the boondocks like that, mm-hmm. We didn't like it. Most of the time where we flew, you could look around and see another helicopter. Physically see them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's made you feel comfortable that mm-hmm. you had somebody that could pick you up on the radio and get you out of there.
Yeah.
So,
did you ever help relocate a village or hamlet?
No, I hauled, I don't know what I was doing, okay?
Mm-hmm.
With the Special Forces, somehow, besides their Special Forces camp, they'd lend us across, and we'd go into the Marines, like at Hoi An was the name of it. We'd pick up villagers there, mm-hmm. pigs, chickens, you know, people, kids, and everything else. And they'd just tell us to go over and pick them up. And I don't know what the relationship was between the Special Forces, and I assume that was some Arvin groups there, but it was a Marine base, and we were picking civilians up there, hauling them to Da Nang. You know, they couldn't drive on the road mm-hmm. or anything, and we'd pick them up and take them in there.
This is Hoi An?
Yeah, Hoi An. Then, well, excuse me. Hoi An was on the... On the beach,
mm-hmm.
and then Anwa was the big base in the same river,
mm-hmm.
and it was inbound, and that was a Marine base, mm-hmm. but we'd land there and pick up some people from the Special
hmm.
Forces,
hmm.
you know, civilians. Yeah. I don't know the relationship.
Were they Montagnards that you're picking up?
No. They were just regular Vietnamese.
Vietnamese peasants.
And maybe they were, the Special Forces camps had South Vietnamese out there,
mm-hmm.
so it's very possible these were their relatives or something. Mm-hmm. I never did know. You know, we just go haul wherever they told us to, but I never moved any villages that I'm aware of. Anything I picked up, I'd pick them up, mm-hmm. Just around there. Now, we'd do a snatch mission occasionally.
What do you mean?
You'd go out, and they just at random snatch Vietnamese out of rice paddies. And you just land, they'd point a gun at them, get them on the helicopter, a couple
mm-hmm.
guys jump off, grab them, chuck them up on the helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one I ever did, picked up five or six different places, took them in, and I took off, and I was doing something else, hauling supplies. They called me after a while and said, come back and get them. So I load them up, and Americans with them,
mm-hmm.
and there were two. And they said, okay, take them out. And I said, we're two. And the guy looked, and he said, that's not our job. That's your job to figure out. You're supposed to mark where we got them at. And I said, nobody ever told me that because I've never flown this mission. So the crew and I, we tried to figure it out. And I think there was five, and we knew we got three of them. We could identify three. The last one, we land, and he's sitting there looking around. He's shaking his head no. And the American says, is this the right spot? And I said, yeah, I'm sure this is the right spot because we don't know where to take them to. Chong, out he goes. And we figure he had a long walk to get home. Because we'd smashed him over about a 10-15 mile area out through there. Just random.
Mm-hmm.
Just flying around. They'd say, oh, we head out this direction. They would bring him in, interrogate him. Trying to just pick up movements.
Mm-hmm.
After I did it once, I knew how to handle it from then on. But that happened once every 3 or 4 weeks, something like that. Do a snatch mission, they mm-hmm. call it.
Just go out, snatch some Vietnamese, take them to...
Yeah, but you're stashing them out in the boonies. I mean, you're getting out where no friendlies are or nothing. Mm-hmm. You know, these are, call them Viet Cong, you didn't shoot them, but they, mm-hmm. you know, clearly they knew where the enemy was. Mm-hmm. The question was, would they talk about it or not? And that would work, so.
Would the intelligence gathered from those snatch missions, are you familiar with anything that was used for a particular operation?
Nah. They kept us like mushrooms, you know, kept us in the dark and fed us manure, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, we really didn't know. Occasionally, I remember them telling us on those big combat assaults, they'd say, guys, we think there's four anti-aircraft guns out here. You know, they would tell us mm-hmm. that, and everybody would roll their eyes like, mm-hmm. holy crap, you know. And but other than that, I don't remember much us getting much intelligence. Mm-hmm. And remember them talking about it, you know. There was always scuttlebutt around as to what unit was moving in the area, and and the North Vietnamese moved different units in. We fought the North Vietnamese in there. We did have some main force BC, but most of the time in this one valley, it was North Vietnamese, big time, big units, you know, and fresh out of the North. I saw them bring some wounded in one day. They had starch. They had pleats down the front of their pants. We were sitting there looking at that, and we couldn't believe it. You know, like, how in the world are these guys this clean? You know, here we look like grease monkeys, you know, with grease all over us and stuff. So.
What about the briefings that you received prior to the missions? Did you find that the intelligence aspects of those were accurate?
Oh, when they expected something, we always got shot at, you know. It was one of those deals. But the first time I flew into Laos with the Special Forces, I've got the story here, May the 20th of 68. I'll never forget that day. And we go into this bunker, and the guy says, leave your wallets, your dog tags, and any other identification there on the table. And I look around, and they'd already lined up before we walked in there. They already had like 10, 15 helicopters lined up. And us old boys, we didn't pay much attention to that. We just walked on in. And this guy gets up there, and he's CIA because he had no markings on, no nothing. And he's got him a chalkboard in there, and he gets up, and he tells us how we're going to fly like a World War II bombers. We're going to go out, and we're going to fly. And he even told us what formation we're going to fly in out here. And we're going to use our machine guns. You know, that's how they protect the World War II bombers. They'd use the machine guns to all this. And he's sitting here telling all this stuff. And we're all sitting here. And I knew a few of the other guys. There was only two helicopters from our company, the two that were coming out of the Special Forces there. And the rest of these guys, I knew some of these cab guys. And they were the first cab. And we're sitting there looking at each other. And everybody's looking around like, God darn, you know. And then he tells us, he says, we don't have any radio contact with them. We lost radio contact out there this morning, and they were throwing hand grenades up in the LZ. And we're sitting there looking, and I had just moved across, and at that time I was really a Peter Pollard. I wasn't an aircraft commander, but I had been one, and I wasn't about. I think in my book I said he had about as much chance getting me to go out there as he would telling me to ride a donkey to Hanoi. And you know, I looked around, and luckily one of these cab guys jumped up, and he said, "Sir, we don't land in LZs unless we've got radio contact." And this old boy was cool. He said, "What do you suggest?" And he said, "I suggest we have somebody go drop a radio in there and see if there's anybody there." And he said, "Well, let's do it." And I don't know who said, "Let's draw straws." And we drew straws as to who had to go take that helicopter, the radio in. And the old boy that got the long one or the short one that had to go, one of his buddies said, "I'll follow you out there." And I saved a book. I said, "Now that's what a buddy is right there," because he didn't have to go. And he said, "I'll follow you out there and, you know, pick you up if something happens." And two of them went out, and we got radio contact with them. And then he'd already marked off the 37mm all anti-aircraft guns, and they'd already knocked down a couple of helicopters and been shooting holes in all the jets. And they declared it, apparently, we didn't know at the time, a prairie fire. And that was the code word for dragging all the aircraft. That takes command over all your other missions. And when we showed up out there, we were the second helicopter in. And I looked up, and I saw teams of jets, and they had them stacked 10, 12 high out there.
Wow.
Not a round was fired at us, because they knew the first guy that fired was fixing to get burnt. And we went in there, and all we wanted to do was pull the dead and the wounded out, and we got them out.
Wow. Was that a single shot fired?
Not a single round was fired at, not to my knowledge.
Not
you. Yeah, and they knew we had arrived with the heavy stuff when you had all those phantoms up there circling, just waiting, you know, just aim me at them, you know. And I'll tell you an interesting story coming out. We were second ship in. The Americans wouldn't get on the helicopter. And we were demanding the helicopters, the Americans, get on the first helicopter. They wouldn't get on. And they loaded bodies. And we were madder than heck, and these were Cambodian mercenaries. And we're flying back in, and the crew chief says, "Look back here, you're not going to believe this." And they had gold teeth, and that was their savings accounts. I didn't know that till we landed, and this crew chief said, "I'm going to take me one of those." And I said, "You leave him alone, get back there where you're supposed to be." And so we landed, and I walked over one of these, and the widows were there, all they were in you. Who was dead, and all the widows were there screaming and hollering and raising heck, and they told us to get off the pad and shut down or something. So we pulled over and shut down, and this old sergeant was standing there. I walked over and I said, "What's with all that gold, all their gold teeth? I mean, some of them, just the whole top was just solid gold." And he said, "That's their savings accounts." And I said, "Well, my crew chief is going to take one." And he said, "It's a good thing he didn't, because they'd already radioed in how many, you know, if one had some shot out or something, and they already knew." And he said, "Boy, there'd been some big time trouble." You know, and I went over and told my crew chief, I mean, "You idiots, you'd have got killed right here." You know, and then the, you know, everybody's like, "Oh my God," you know. But I didn't know if you'd ever heard that story. And I read somewhere else they paid them in gold, which is consistent with the gold teeth. You know, was that we had to pay those mercenaries in gold, because they wouldn't take money. You know, South Vietnamese money, they didn't want it. You know, so.
Wow. Well, when you left Vietnam, where did you go, and what was the reception like?
I went home to my hometown down in Joshua, Texas, and then I was stationed in Mineral Wells, Texas, which is only about 50 miles away. Mm-hmm. And down in there, I hear these stories about everybody getting spit on and stuff like that. I question those stories. Mm. I mean, if you're somewhere echelon smug, you might let somebody spit on you. The guys I know, you spit on one of them, you take your life in your hands. And I haven't heard one of them say anybody spit on them.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that happened or not. It could have happened, but it certainly didn't happen to me. Mm-hmm. And I was received very warmly by everybody, and I never had anybody say anything derogatory to me. I had the only thing I ever had said to me, right when I got in, they interviewed me at the campus, the base newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
They were interviewing new arrivals back out of Vietnam, and they asked me what the worst thing was, and I said it was going in picking up the wounded. So I go to my flight. They assigned you to a flight, and I taught new students how to fly helicopters. And this idiot is in there, pilot warrant officer. He said, "Read your interview in the paper, you're whining like some sissy or something." And I asked him, I said, "What'd you do in Vietnam?" "Don't worry, I did the same thing you did." So I snooped around. He flew generals around or something. You know, and I wanted to kick his butt. You know, but that really made me mad when he said that. You know, because I did. You know, they just asked me, "What was the worst thing you did?" And I said, "Hauling the wounded." You know, but that shocked me, and I remember that being said to me. And that was the only thing I thought that was really bizarre. You know, and didn't even know where this guy was coming from. But no, that was the only thing I remember was of anything said, because I was lucky in that area. There weren't any war protesters or anything like that, you know. So they got killed down in Texas, you know.
Were there any particular experiences that you recall that prompted you to say that was the worst part of it? Carrying back, going.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I've got this in my book. The day Wiegand and I, we were in a gunship and went in and picked these first cab wounded up. This guy was crying over the radio, and what happened, all the medevac had been shot up that day, and the first cab was out there moving through this unit. This four AmeriCal got formed.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy was crying over the radio, and he had to withdraw. He had to pull back out of this area, and if we didn't come get him, he was going to have to carry him. And he said, "My boys are going to get hurt if we have to carry these out." And he had some bodies too. And a Wiegand, he says, "I'll go in and get them." So he jettisoned his rocket pods, and he's the head of aviation for the state of Virginia now. And he remembers this sort of the same way.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, "What are you doing this for? Because we weren't supposed to do this." And he said, "Darn sure weren't supposed to inject your rocket pods, you know, because those are hard to get." And he said, "I officially leave Vietnam. I don't have a distinguished flying cross, and they'll give me one for doing this." And that was the day, without me going into the story, it scared me so bad, I tensed up that I apparently pulled a chest muscle. I thought I had a heart attack. And years later, he and I talked about what happened, and the first time we talked, his story was totally different than what I remembered. And when I was writing the book, I decided I'm going to straighten this story out, because it's not correct. And Wiegand got a pretty good memory. And what had happened, I misunderstood. The infantry guy was crying over the radio. And I understood him to say once we landed, the friendlies would be to my left. What he meant was the wounded and the dead were to my left.
Mm-hmm.
remember sitting in there, both of us on the controls, and Wiegand already said, "Now, I want you flying this helicopter for me. If I get shot, I expect you to get us out of here."
Mm-hmm.
I look up to my 1 o'clock position. I see three people standing in there with guns, and it looked like they were aimed at me. And it scared me so bad I tensed up and tore a chest muscle. And Wiegand later on, I wrote this up in the book, he said, "Carlock, any idiot would have known they were Americans, because if they were an enemy, you wouldn't have had a chance to see them. They'd have shot the heck out of you." And I said, "Yeah, you're really right." But that's the first rice paddy ever landed in.
Mm.
See, I was a brand new rookie. I hadn't been there long, and scared the crap out of me.
Mm-hmm.
And he never got a medal for it. He got chewed. He nearly got court-martialed for it. Yeah.
For jettisoning his rockets.
Right, and Parsons went down. One of the guys went down the next day. He was off, and he went down to the hospital to see what happened to him. One of them lived. And boy, he was hurt. And and I remember the crew chief said, "Don't turn around and look." Naturally, I turned around. Once we got up there, I turned around and looked. I mean, it was the goriest mess you've ever seen, you know. And that's the first time I've ever seen anything like that. I'll never forget that, you know. Mm-hmm. You can't look at that without remembering it, you know. And how some of these medics do, I'll never know. I don't know how they train them where that doesn't bother them, you know. Mm-hmm. But
all right, this is CD number 2, the interview with Chuck Carlock. All right, so were there any other operations that stuck out in your mind as far as in reinforcing that aspect of how difficult it was to pick up wounded?
I remember looking around to this guy that got hit with a landmine. That was pretty interesting. He had no clothes on. They threw him in there with no clothes, and it looked like he had little red spots all over him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the guy, I think he was sitting there smoking a cigarette. Can't remember, maybe laying there smoking a cigarette, and mm-hmm. like there was nothing wrong. And I knew that boy was in big, big trouble. And I remember looking around at him, but most of the time I didn't look around. I put a whole lot of them, I never looked around. And it was... Right now, that's about the only ones I remember looking mm-hmm. around, but I didn't like it after that day in that gunship. That was the worst thing I'd ever seen. And but we used to see them. We used to camp next to the medic tent up at Hill 3-5.
Mm-hmm.
And this doc, he had this bizarre sense of humor, and he'd get the guys over. I didn't go over very often, but he was always trying to gross them out, you know, stuff. And But we saw some stuff over there that was shocking, too, you know, just bringing in wounded
mm-hmm.
and South Vietnamese. They'd bring in Vietnamese wounded,
mm-hmm.
Trying to keep them alive long enough to interrogate them a little bit. North Vietnamese soldiers, you know, they'd grab them and try to get them in before they died, see if they could get any info out of them and
mm-hmm.
stuff. And so they were bringing out, you wonder why they'd be bringing North Vietnamese soldiers in over there, you know. I stole one of them a belt buckle one day. The only thing he owned was, and I've got it mounted up over here, a piece of wire.
Mm-hmm.
That was his belt buckle, and he was still alive. And he was laying there, and he had this scared look about him, and I was trying to give me a souvenir, you know, and I thought, well, that's the only thing that old boy's got. So I pulled out my knife, and I cut off his belt buckle, and he's looking at me like, "I'm going to get you, boy."
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
I'll never get that. You know, sort of giving back to him.
What other trophies did you bring back?
That was about it. I had a bunch of stuff. I was going to bring my Sten gun back with a silencer. I've told this story a couple times at the reunion. They mm-hmm. let you bring a box home. So this guy that was in charge of putting the bands on the box, he's supposed to check it. Well, I knew him real well.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, he came over and he put the bands on. He said, "Now listen, if you got anything in here illegal, they're going to catch it down here at the port, and then you're going to get court-martialed. You're going to spend another 30 days over here."
Mm-hmm.
I was sitting there, you know, I didn't say anything. So he left. I sit there and look at that box a minute, and I had my Sten gun with silencer and had a grease gun in there,
mm-hmm.
45 caliber grease gun. And I really don't care anything about those guns. So anyway, I cut the bands, took them out, and went over and I said, "Hey, Cahill, you need to come back and put the bands back on my box." And he's laughing. He said, "I knew you had something in there you weren't supposed to have. What do you have in there?" And I don't worry about it. You know,
mm-hmm.
I got to sell it. I got to find a buyer quick.
Well, were there actual cases where guys got court-martialed for that you were aware of?
I've heard rumors about it, but most of the time they're said that my box never got opened.
Yeah.
I actually marked on it to see if they put new bands on it as to where they were, and no, they didn't even look in that box. And it was a random kind of check, and so that box I could have got at home. I've heard a guy, I know a guy's got an AK-47, and he told me he'd give it to me. You know, full automatic.
Mm-hmm.
No. I don't want it. Don't even want around it. You know, I don't need stuff like that. And He sent it home.
Was that a Class 3 license?
Yeah, right. And but anyway, no, I don't want it. Don't need that, you uh-huh. know. So.
Well, in what ways did the war affect you most?
My wife might have different stories on this. My deal was, I was trying to do something in my life. I didn't have time to think about it. I wanted to work. Mm-hmm. And being an instructor was, you know, automatically went right into a training school. I can't remember how long, 2 weeks or something, and training those students. Then I started college. So as a flight instructor, you work a half a day mm-hmm. in the mornings 1 week and then in the afternoon the next week. And then I took classes alternate, you know, the local college that gave them to us. I went right into staying real busy. Mm-hmm. And I attribute some of that to the fact that I didn't even thought about it. And, you know, people say, oh, I had nightmares and all that. I never even thought about it. I was too busy getting on with my life, you mm-hmm. know. And I've heard there's a whole bunch of guys tell you that, you know. Yeah. If you just got it going mm-hmm. and, you know, at that age, you're supposed to get on with your life and start doing something. And yeah. So I'm convinced that's what the vast majority of them did. And you have some guys that might have had problems anyway. We have some that are drawing that PTSD, and more than just some that we know were whacked before they ever set foot in Vietnam. And just percentage-wise, you're going to have some anyway. And, you know, they're blaming it all on Vietnam and all that stuff. And, you know, I question that. And then some of them maybe couldn't get on with their lives for some reason, IQ-wise or something like that. And maybe they had trouble, mm-hmm. you know, sitting around thinking about it, you know. Mm-hmm. But I have mixed views on that stuff, yeah. you know, and stuff. To whether it really affects them, because you have to look. And I was telling this to a doctor one time. He was a periodontist, a gum doctor, you know. And he mm-hmm. says, you have to remember, some people are pretty fragile, you know. And he said, you know, a fragile person, it doesn't take near as much to drive them over the edge. And he said, with our training, there weren't any fragile people left in that group, you know. They mm-hmm. were all long gone. So so maybe some of the other fragile guys that didn't do a lot, maybe they do have some excuse for what happened. But mm-hmm. I think a lot of them are phonies, if you want to get down to it. And, yeah. They're going to have trouble anyway. And, mm-hmm. and we assist our guys. Anybody that wants to draw that government money, we help them. Hmm. And I won't get into some of their jobs. We've got a bunch of them drawing it. We're not in a combat situation. And we assist as best we can to help them get their stuff.
You're talking about guys that belong to the 71st Tech Helicopter
right.
Company
Right, and they
work
different jobs. You had all kinds of jobs yeah. around the company here, and uh-huh. I won't call off their skills because right. I know who I'm talking about, but they never went outside the base camp, and they're drawing it, and they technically qualify, and so be it. Help them get the money. I'd rather them get it than some phony get it, you know. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. But we actually know they were there, and we did get shot at. They shoot rockets at us and uh-huh. stuff like that in the company here. But
how often? Would you get?
Oh, there's different TET during TET, mm-hmm. That May the 5th and in August. TET 3, they call it, was in August. And mm-hmm. I was down there. I went down to get a new helicopter that day, and that's in my book. And I saw a gunfight going on right out there with a jet in broad daylight. And I said, and this guy on the flight line says, words hit us, they're going to try to overrun us tonight. And I said, I'm out of here, man. Give me that helicopter. So I go up to Nang, they overrun that place. You know, they really do. So I nearly get killed up to Nang, but I want to get out of that place. You mm-hmm. know, so. Anyway.
Well, speaking of problems that veterans have faced since the war, what about the Agent Orange controversy? And was your unit ever in an area that they supposedly used Agent Orange? And
well, I have. Oh, yes. And I've got mixed views. I'll tell you the story on that. We had, you know, I know some people that were in that ranch hand mm-hmm. test. You know, they used to drink it and all kinds of stuff, and mm-hmm. I go off the assumption that whenever you offer money out there, there's going to be people lining up to get the money, okay? Just off my experience of human nature, you know? Mm-hmm. But I told this guy, I said, we only had one guy that I know of that sprayed Agent Orange. He was the only guy in our company that did it, and you'd spray it out of that helicopter, you'd get it all over you. Mm-hmm. He has two different kinds of nerve diseases. He came to our first reunion in Dallas, which is really our second one, but first big one, mm-hmm. and he couldn't stay long. I didn't get a chance to see him. Well, I saw him up in St. Louis. he says that if he watches his diet, he only eats the stems out of plants. He can't eat anything that grows underground. He can't eat anything that grows on top of any kind of plant. And he eats a plant out of India. And he said they found that for his whatever he's got, that he doesn't have an attack. And he's skinny as heck. He was skinny in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. This guy's in bad shape. And he was our Agent Orange sprayer. And he said, he told some of the guys it was a nerve disease, which is what they're trying to say Agent Orange causes. He told us he thought it was something to do with his diabetic. He was a diabetic along with it. So, mm-hmm. But he's got something bizarre wrong with him. And he came and stayed with us about 4 or 5 hours out there. And he said, I got to go, I'm so weak. And he's got to be weak. He doesn't eat anything. Yeah. You see? And, but the docs have figured that out, that if he'll stay away from whatever's in potato and whatever's in leaves like lettuce, he can't handle it, and it sets off some kind of nervous thing.
Wow.
Yeah.
What about meat and stuff?
No, nothing. No. No,
he can't
eat it. He can't eat anything. And we were at the restaurants, and he couldn't eat either. There was nothing on the menu he could eat. I think he said he'd eat asparagus. Asparagus is the...
Yeah. He can it's eat almost all stem.
Stem. Mm-hmm. Stems is what he can eat. Strange deal.
That is. Do you know if he suffered from the neurasthenic disorder where he can't feel the extremities, fingers?
I don't. I didn't get into it. I didn't want to grill him too much because you would tell he was in bad shape, and you know some of it could be mental too. I mean, it's a strange deal. He spent some time with us, but he was our guy that sprayed Agent Orange. And mm-hmm. What that means, I don't know, but I found that pretty interesting. That he's got some bizarre wrong with him, you know.
How would they rig up a helicopter to spray Agent Orange?
Put orange arms on the side and then put a tank up in the back. And you imagine when you're putting it in the tank, it's everywhere, but that helicopter doesn't trim out right, so when you're making a turn, you're getting all the spray back in the thing, and nobody liked doing it because it just covered the whole... It's like diesel oil, so you got diesel oil on that stinking helicopter, so you got to clean that thing from top to bottom. And I never sprayed it. I saw him spraying it before. They spray it around these fire bases. Mm-hmm. And instead of bringing in one of those great big planes that use these helicopters to kill it around. And then sometimes they spray stuff out there that start fires. They spray it and then light a fire to it. I don't know if it did or just killed everything. But later you'd find it burn everything around it. So, but he was our guy, and he's jacked up. So,
Did most units have that, as far as someone who would fly the Agent Orange? And
I don't know. I imagine most units did. We were flying for the 196 at that time. Now, whether he went down and did it for the whole AmeriCal division, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I just, the only time I ever saw him spraying it was out for the 196. So if that's all he did it for, then you had somebody doing it for the other regiments in the DLC. Mm-hmm. But I'm not positive on that.
Were there any other ways that the war affected you? Affected your life?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have no regrets about what went on. I can be in a business meeting and I'm bored and I'm sitting there and I look at these other guys and I've told this out here a couple of times already. I said, I can sit there and think how boring their lives are. You know, they have a bad day playing golf and that's traumatic to them. You know, I mean, that's a big deal, you know. And I sit there and I look at that like, my God, man, if that's all you got going wrong in your life, or that's all the thing that excites you, a guy comes in and says, man, I shot a two to the, I don't even know the rules out there, but, you know, let's say he knocked a hole in one. I've never known anybody do one, but, you know, that's a big event in his life, you know, that's nothing, you know.
So I guess it gives you a different perspective.
It gives you a total different look, and like we got one of our guys that's a big business consultant. And decision making, you can make decisions a lot quicker than other people can, and I've seen that in my career. That like yesterday, I was on a big conference call, and I said, I polled everybody. I said, everybody, can anybody find anything wrong with this decision? But the decision had to be made, and they know they can always call me, and I'll make a decision. Because you know, you can argue which one is right, but you always get everybody's opinion on it. So if anybody says no, you're flat wrong, you know. And if everybody says, well, it's all right with me, well. They know I'll always just make a decision because, you know, it's no big deal. You know? What are they going to do, send you to Vietnam? You know? Shoot you? No.
Right. And what are the major lessons you think we should take away from the Vietnam War?
Two things. Number one, the military shouldn't be run by a bunch of screwballs that get into something. And they, you're seeing this, and I think you're going to see it go away once your Vietnam guys get out of there, but you should never go anywhere unless you intend to win. You got to have a winning strategy. You shouldn't put a guy's, because the American people will support it. And so that's one thing. You need to have a plan to win. And then the other thing is, and this is what really hacks me off, and I want to just throw an interview, maybe it shouldn't go here, is these wild-eyed, bomb-throwing liberals that got us into that war. And then I sit there and watch CBS News other than that, and they say, the war America lost. Now, anybody with an ounce of sense knows who lost that was the liberal Congress that shut the money off to the South Vietnamese in 1974 and 1975. When you go to rationing an army down to 12 bullets a day per man, you can't hold off guys that have AK-47s with full packs of ammo, you know, and anybody, and you know, no artillery shells, and especially when they're taught to fight like we fought with all that, using up that stuff. Those guys didn't have a chance. And say America lost it, and it just happened. That's been my views. And then the Wall Street Journal ran a deal by old Webb that used to be under Reagan, VA or something. And he said, you know, he says, he thinks public perception is changing over the years, that they're going to finally come around to that. That you know, you look at what the Vietnamese do, and the more you look, the winners, call them the winners, what they've done to that country over there and how those people live. You know, they're a fourth world country, and that's what communism always does. Power, absolute power, because it corrupts, and that's what you have when you have a government like that. And so I blame it all on the liberals. Had to get that in here.
Oh, absolutely. What?
And we, American soldier didn't lose that war.
Right.
As I seen a T-shirt one time, when I left, we were winning. Yeah. Now, I say that. I wrote home. That's unfair. That's an old man's perspective. I'll tell you this. In my letters, I wrote home, and I told my mother. I said, "Tell my brother to get out and start protesting this war. We shouldn't be over here." And then I think in another letter I said, you know, I should have went to Canada. So I was not a big fan of this deal. I don't think that's inconsistent with what I just said about, you know, the Army shouldn't have got in without winning. But I was prepared to get out of that place, you know, without really knowing the total, you know, concept of who the South Vietnamese were, what the strategy was. I figured out real quick we were in a situation where we weren't going to win it the way we were doing it. So. So it's unfair. That's what causes wars. Old men like me sit around. We start thinking, boy, we were pretty macho back then. We'll go out there and kick some butt. And that's what they do. They get the young boys out there and get them killed, you know. And that's what leads to war. You know?
What led you to write those letters? What do you remember what sparked those opinions that formed?
Part of it was after I saw what the South Vietnamese were doing. You know, they were stealing everything. Like when I needed socks, I sent a crew guy down. We were talking about it. I sent a crew guy down to their village to buy my socks, Army socks.
So you witnessed corruption?
Witnessed, heck yeah. That's where we had to go get our supplies. You know, and our food, they were starving to death. I mentioned that in the book. I don't know if you ever heard what Westmoreland's top sergeant over there, they caught him stealing all the money. He was stealing a lot of the PX money or the fund money for food at Chulai, where I was at. One of the places that they were stealing a lot of money was where I was at. And our food was horrible. It had, the biscuits had weevils in them. The meat was green. I talk about that in my book. One day I was fed, I went out to a fire base to eat, but I had roast beef three times offered me that day, and I couldn't eat this stuff. It was horrible. It didn't even taste like meat. They had so much chemical and rot in it. So the food was terrible over there. And come find out they were stealing our money for the food there. And but that was probably my attitude, that we shouldn't be there, because I didn't think that our side was doing enough, the South Vietnamese. They were standing around watching us fight, what it really got down to. And that where old Anton got captured, they had a South Vietnamese base out there, Rough Puff Camp. They never fought each other. They just paid them off, you know. And I mean, they were just right out there, and they were right out there, and we wouldn't even want to fly around this place. And here they had a Rough Puff Camp right out in the middle of nowhere would we want to go, and they never even fought each other. So, and that's where Carson walked into. That's how they got him. He made it back to that camp.
What do you mean they paid
ripped them off.
Apparently, they somehow they had some deal cut where they didn't fight. You know, and but there's no way to explain. You know, American base be out here and they'd attack it and fight each other. And so there's old rough-ups over there. They couldn't, you know, all they had a couple strands of barbed wire around them. They could have wiped them out in 2 seconds, you know, and they just let them go. And the only thing we'd figure they were giving them medical supplies, something like that. Mm-hmm. But that was just talked about. And that's the reason you say, what are we doing over here, you know? I've heard there's a lot of this is this crazy culture stuff they had, you know, that you couldn't say anything, you insult them, all that. Well, like the Koreans, I heard in the Korean War, we took over and appointed their generals. Those generals were actually under our military structure. Mm-hmm. And Westmore, I'd read somewhere where he said he wouldn't want to do that because of their type of culture they had, which is a bunch of crap. They should have run all those sorry generals off and got them some good ones. And they had good ones. I'm sure they did. They had good fighting men, I'm sure. But it really comes down to sergeant level. And if they see so much corruption up above them, they're not going to fight. I mean, they're not going to lead those guys to fight. And so I blame them. You know, maybe that was the problem. But that was my attitude on getting out. I didn't like what I was seeing the South Vietnamese do on our side. And we certainly looked down on them as to, you know, we made jokes about them. Call it racist, call it whatever. These guys were on our side, you know. And but part of it is the fact they weren't doing anything, you know. And our guys were out there getting killed, and these guys sitting there doing nothing. So, and anytime we worked with them, you get count on getting in an ambush because they already had tipped the other side up. Well, the joke was it might as well put billboards or drop leaflets out there. Here we come, you know. And, strange deal. So there was no love loss between a lot of people and them. Now, I'm not saying that's true of all of them.
Was that opinion shared by other aviators in your unit? Did you talk much about this? Or?
Yeah, we made jokes about it, but I would say that opinion was pretty clear, and you could talk to some of our other people. And I think you'd get a consensus there that was the true state of things. I know some of the Special Forces guys liked the guys they were with. A lot of those were mountain yards and stuff, but we were not impressed at all. And I'll tell you a story. My father was shocked and had this in my book, and I took it out myself because I knew they were going to read it. I'd sponsored some Vietnamese after Vietnam fell. And so anyway, I took my students. I had an all Vietnamese class. I had three students. Took them to my hometown, introduced my dad, and we were doing something, went to a ball game or something. And he asked me, he said, well, why'd you want to be a helicopter pilot? And he said, well, what happens, you can make a lot of money selling kerosene. You buy it in the city and take it out to the villages and sell it, and you make three times your money on it. And this was he was the number one student in his class. Very brilliant guy. And, you know, I sort of respected this guy. And he said that, and my father fell out of his chair, and I did too. And there was nothing wrong in his culture when he said that. There was nothing wrong with that. He couldn't see anything wrong with that. He wasn't embarrassed. He didn't think anything about it. And to an American, I knew it fell out of my chair. My dad, he was, my gosh, he didn't say it to me. He waited till they left, and he said, moly smokes. You know? Very strange deal. And how you root that out of a culture. They're saying it's a Mandarin culture, a Chinese kind of governmental thing that was pushed down through there, and the North Vietnamese purged that out with their communist propaganda at that time. And who knows? That's open to debate. But that shows you the attitude of some of those people.
Well, one of the big problems now was corruption.
So. Yeah, right. So, and I guarantee it's North and South. I've been over there, so it's just as bad up in the North as it is now. I can't see how what's going on right today, I don't see how they fought a war against us as good as they did, you know.
What did you think of the Paris Peace Accords of 1973?
Well, I say in my book there, they announced that, I believe, in March of 68, and I ran through the company air. I heard it on Radio Vietnam that they were going to have peace talks. And I ran through the company air telling everybody the war's over. They're fixing to have a ceasefire. And then they fought for months over the shape of the table. You know, give me a break. And that could have been when I was saying, you know, tell my brother to get out there and peace protest. And I was just shocked, you know, like, what in the world, you know?
And you know, they should have taken North Vietnam, put them back to the Stone Age, and that's what they did later on when Nixon finally turned on. Nixon apparently cleared that with the Chinese and the Russians, and he said, "I'm fixing to blow these guys away." And I don't know if he had real permission from them, but he went there and smoked them. Mm-hmm. And you know, they were crying uncle in about what 12 days or something. And we were just fixing to put them to the Stone Age, and they cried uncle. And that 12 days could have happened a lot easier, a lot less people killed back when Johnson was there. Mm-hmm. Except Johnson probably was worried about the Chinese coming in. So, yeah. Hindsight, I don't think they would have come in. Yes. Based on them fighting the Vietnamese, they weren't prepared to come in. Mm-hmm. You know. Other than us slaughtering them, you know.
How about the importance of the Vietnam War in the context of the Cold War?
Well, I've read all of that. I don't think there's any doubt that based on their, I'm talking about the Russians and the Chinese, there was limited stuff that they could produce. They pumped a lot of their economic output into that war. Because mm-hmm. we were pumping a lot of ours, and they were pumping a lot of theirs, and theirs wasn't near as big as ours. So, mm-hmm. there's no doubt that, you know, AK-47s that they were trying to use on us would have been in these other countries and a lot of their other armaments. And you know, they laugh about that. The liberals have written history where, you know, who knows what would have happened. They're saying, well, there wouldn't have been a domino effect, but shoot, you know, North Vietnam wouldn't have took the South, and then they went in and took Cambodia and Laos. And who says what would have stopped them if they still had the backing that they had? You know, those people had, what, the fifth largest army in the world or something, and it was armed up and well trained, you know. So who knows what would have happened. But I haven't really thought about that much as to whether that really was any good coming out of that. But I'm convinced that, you know, they blame it on the politicians. I blame it more on the Liberal Congress. When they, you know, the war was technically lost in 1975, and it was lost when they cut off the supplies to those people. And the people that cut it off were the darn old war protesters. They got elected to Congress. And you go and you count some of them that were in there, and they were the ones doing it, you know. And they swung that vote and cut that aid off. No, people didn't have a chance then. You could have defended some of those cities over there, Da Nang and some of those others, with just a few good artillery pieces. They couldn't just, wasn't this flat ground when they run in on you. They could only come in from one direction. Mm-hmm. And all it took was plenty of artillery shells, and that's still on today, at least. I don't know about some of the others, but probably Chulai. They could have held Chulai forever, too, with some good artillery. Mm-hmm. Couldn't have rooted them out of that place either. So
what did you think when that happened, when the decision was made not to continue supplying Vietnam?
I really wasn't, you know, I was working for a living, and I really wasn't in on that. Mm-hmm. I remember when the thing fell apart. But I still blamed our allies. I still questioned what in the world we were doing supporting those guys. You know, if they didn't want to fight for themselves, you know, what in the world were we doing over there? Mm-hmm. And so I did have a negative attitude toward them. And like I say, I had some stuff in my book, and I cut it out myself because mm-hmm. I just didn't want to be derogatory to them. Because it's not fair. There's some people that fought for, and there's no doubt there was a lot of them in there that fought for what they thought was right. But anytime you have a culture that gets that corrupt, you know, nationality or national pride, you know, who knows what was going on. But it's hard to get that when everybody's stealing everything and hits the boat dock, you know. Mm-hmm. So, anyway.
Anything else you'd like to add?
No. I think that's it. Talked long enough.
All right. Well, then this ends the interview with Chuck Carlock.